Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, sitting on a roof with our friends here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Philoscope. That was incredible. And one of your better ones.
And with us tonight, save the best for last, Phil. With us tonight is Matt Newman. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm glad that you called that out because I my notes got increasingly less comprehensive as I drank to get through this film. Right. And I have one that just says, undies on the roof with one sock, ! Point. So it's fitting. Yeah.
It's before we get into the many, many varied adventures of Sebastian Cole. Real buildings Roman of a flick.
Yeah.
Matt, it's nice to see you on Zoom. We know Matt from Twitter, where we have engaged with him many times. I don't know how we're setting these episodes up. We'll figure it out at a later date, but I'm just gonna do it now. As many of you know, As many of you know, the podcast is coming to an end. We're close to the end of our 1999 run, and there are some movies that we really don't want to do. So we thought it would be fun. We thought it would be fun to reach out to some of the people we've met through Twitter over the course of the 5-year run and put them through the same kind of hell we have to go through on a semi-regular basis.
That's the perfect way of putting it. Yeah.
Matt Newman stepped up and was willing to watch The Adventures of Sebastian Cole, the 91-minute Adrian Grenier Clark Gregg movie that is about not what you'd expect.
Not what you think. I texted Kenny after, because I do a document every week, and I you know, pasted in the synopsis, and I texted Kenny. I was like, do you know what Adventures of Sebastian Cole's about? And then obviously he Googled it and he's like, I had no idea. Like, this is, first of all, like, you could have told me it was about anything and I would have been like, sure. I mean, I don't know.
I'll tell you what, this has been Matt, we're going to talk to you in a second. Yeah. But like, this has been on our list from the beginning, obviously, as all these films have been. And it has a title, Sticks in Your Head. And
it kind of does, weirdly, though. It sounds good.
A solid title.
It's
a little mellifluous. Yeah. And for me in particular, I know this is extremely like lame shit and like totally irrelevant to everyone else in the world. But my son is named Cole and his best friend is named Sebastian. So it was always kind of funny to me that there was eventually named Sebastian Cole starring my good friend Andrew Grenier. So just
shocked you didn't come on the podcast for this.
Yeah, I mean, well,
he wouldn't answer my calls.
It should be said though that we did mention this movie back when we did the Drive Me Crazy episode. We talked about like, you know, because obviously
Kenny
and Adrian go way back, you know, all the way back to the Entourage days.
And it should be said, lovely guy, a little quirky, but all the problems, any problem that happened in Entourage had nothing to do with him because he's what you think he is. He's like, he's a professional. Mm-hmm. He's beautiful. And he is like, kind of singularly focused on like his environmental stuff. Like, really,
that's awesome.
He is,
and I would argue he's what, like, near the bottom of my, if I don't have an issue with him on Entourage, I guess is what I'm getting at. I liked him as Vinny. It worked
remarkably. You know what I mean?
He made the show, honestly, like,
kind of. Yeah.
You need to buy into the fact that this guy is a movie star, and despite the fact that, you know, he's not a huge movie star, It works.
He has some ineffable quality.
Yep.
He has an ineffable star on a TV show about being a star quality.
Yes, 100%.
That is not the same as being a star, unfortunately, mm-hmm. for him. And it always held him back for some reason. But that, like, I don't know, Matt. Did you ever watch Saved by the Bell?
Yes, absolutely.
Great, wonderful. Good, now we can go. Do you remember the episode when Johnny Dakota came to school?
100%.
Johnny Dakota has that same quality.
Yeah,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Johnny Dakota was a TV star that came to school to hang out with the Bayside gang, uh-huh, not to hang uh-huh. out. Yeah. He came out to shoot an anti-drug PSA.
Okay.
At Bayside.
Spoiler alert.
turns out he's a dope smoker.
Oh shit.
And so
a hypocrite.
And it was crazy. And Tartikoff was out of the show that, like, Brendan Tartikoff was on the show himself. Like,
oh my God, incredible.
He came at the end and he's like, guys, I'm so sorry I sent you that drug smoker, Johnny Dakota, but would you six cool kids like to do the PSA?
Which would never do drugs. Those kids would never do drugs.
No.
No. Yeah. Well, would I do dope? Nope. That was Zach.
Wait, Jesse does. Life. She does uppers. You know, obviously.
Yeah,
they were caffeine pills. Let's.
Give her a break.
Sorry, it was apologies. It was network TV uppers.
I didn't know.
And
didn't
she
know
was in the middle. She was the middle. She was the middle of like her first run with Hot Sunday. There was a lot of pressure.
Man.
So
I love. Didn't know how deep you could go on Saved by the Bell, Kenny. I didn't.
Me?
I didn't know. I didn't know.
It's weird. 492 episodes into the show, that's the first time it's come up. But I can go down to the bone.
It 100% checks out because I think a big reason that I connected so much with podcasts like It's 99 is because you're both within a 5-year-ish radius of me, and so the context. And like, I worked at a video store. I was that guy. So like, yeah, it's like, but Saved by the Bell, very formative, you know, like a lot of, you know,
it seems
memories.
100%. You guys had Saved by the Bell. I had Degrassi Junior High. I understand.
But Degrassi, you know what I mean? Good.
Yes, I agree with you, but I
very,
just
speaking, very different. Yes. No, but I hear you. No, I'm not.
And you know,
that's back, you know, that's the difference between America and Canada. There, you made a superior product.
Why you're better than us?
That no one cares about.
Yes.
If only people knew how great we all were.
Yeah. Well,
so Matt, you just told us a little bit. We now know that you are, you know, 37 to 45 years old. We previously established before you got on mic that you're in Cincinnati, a city that I visited this summer and have great esteem for or hold in high esteem. Matt, what else should we know about you? What else should the listeners know about you?
Well, can I ask a question? Here's my question.
Please.
I don't mean this to sound self-serving, but how did you hear about the podcast? Like, how did this, I know you were going to get to it, I'm sure.
Anyway, no, I wasn't going to ask it. I just hoped he was going to say it.
Oh man. I mean, well,
you can leave it in your hands.
Yeah.
A little bit of background about me. I am I'm in PR, so I feel like I came with talking points and I knew I had to hit that. So that's
great. There you
go. One of those things. I actually have a really vivid memory of like the first time that I listened to the podcast because it was pre-pandemic. I was not that long moved back to Cincinnati from LA. And I was kind of like just missing talking about movies in the business and was just literally Googling like podcasts about movies, and it came up. And I listened to the Eyes Wide Shut episode was the first one that I listened to. And I was like, this is my shit. This is it.
That's well, so great. I appreciate that. What's interesting is that I don't know if I listened to Eyes Wide Shut, if I would have stuck around. And I only say that, not that's not, you know, I just mean in the sense that like it was our first episode, right? Like I'm sure if Kenny and I listened to that episode now, it would seem like we were had training wheels. You know what I mean? Like it didn't, we hadn't really found our, well, 100%. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. No, I obviously have a thing, but yeah, whatever.
I have it in my mind to go back and watch some or listen to some of the earlier episodes sort of as you guys wrap up because I'm very curious about it. But I do vividly remember it was raining and I was driving home from work and I'm just like listening to like the reminiscences about this movie that was like for me, it's like one of my top three of the year for sure. Yeah. And being like, I love the hits first. But also thinking like, I just feel like I'm listening to two guys that are like into movies that are just having a conversation, which was nice. And it's gotten a lot more polished. And as you've gone along, not that it was bad, but it was, you know, yeah, there's some differences for sure. But yeah, going back to you, Kenny, I'm NPR, grew up here in Ohio. I bounced around a little bit. I was in New York for a while in LA and back here. And my parents will be super stoked about this because my film studies degree, I'm finally...
Good.
Finally.
I'm glad we could help. That's great.
20 plus years later, I'm putting it to good use. I had aspirations to work in the industry and I did the production thing for a couple years and was like, I'm good. I'm just going to like.
Yeah. It's hell.
I get it. It sucks.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't suggest.
We want to blow our brains out on a daily basis. Yeah.
Absolutely not. So it is interesting though, because like I feel like. This film, I found myself thinking a lot about Adrien Grenier for obvious reasons. He is sort of the protagonist of this film, which made me obviously think about Entourage, which in it is, I guess I've never asked you this question, Kenny, but like, do you think that that show was an accurate representation of this industry?
I think that I think it was the most accurate representation of the industry that we've had.
I disagree.
Don't think it was perfect, but to our credit, really to the people who were there before me, I didn't start until season three. So there was, you know, and a lot of this has to do with being on HBO and being paired up with Sopranos. We knew that was something that was going to happen. And, the thing about Sopranos or one of a million things that show ever made that I love about Sopranos is there was no handholding, right?
Yep.
So if there was a term or if there was a situation or if there was a relationship that was, you know, specific to the mob or specific to New Jersey or specific to the law, they didn't tell you, well, you had to figure it out or you had to Google it.
Yeah.
We went the same way. There are things in Entourage that I think seem second nature to us, but for other people, that was hard to, you know, glom onto, hard to kind of figure out. So, and for instance, even like a character like Lloyd, doesn't make a lot of sense to other people who haven't done this. It doesn't make a lot of sense that an adult professional man would be another man's secretary. But he's not a secretary, he's an assistant. And in this industry, you know, it's being an assistant is more like being an apprentice. And that's something that people don't really understand, but it's not something that we ever said what I said, which is have someone come out to Hollywood and be like, I don't want to be a fucking secretary. It's just the way it was. Right. And I do think we deserve credit for that, for that kind of thing and the lack of handholding in that respect. I know,
it should be said too, you know, Kenny and I obviously, you know, as anyone who's listened to this podcast know that we met as assistants at UTA. And I think that as an assistant watching that show, I would say, especially in season two, when I felt like it was really kind of cresting to some degree or another, it felt like someone got it, which was kind of cool.
And even I remember because we were there together on season two, and I remember distinctly being on a TV lit desk the night or the day after the Tsetse Fly episode happened, the best episode of the series.
Yeah.
And agents were going around to other agents going Tsetse Fly. So
yeah.
So every other representation I think people would say is authentic or is realistic are generally movies that hate Hollywood and are skewering Hollywood so hard. And the player is wonderful and amazing, but I'll tell you what, there's no screenwriter killing. There's no executive killing screenwriter and getting deals off.
Not nearly enough.
I understand. Well, I like the other way around, but it's not, it's obviously, I'm not breaking new ground. It's obviously a metaphor. And I think people get that and they like that, but in even everything about the player is so heightened to the point of being, you know, only realistic as a metaphor. I would also say movie we did this year, Bowfinger, which again, to me, not realistic in any way whatsoever, but people in the industry be like, that is what it's like. Yeah. I mean, Chubby Rain is a little too far, but like, that is what it's like. It's
close.
Yeah. We never went there. Like maybe to our detriment, you know, we truly did try to have Vince be in the kind of movies that a guy like Vince might actually be in.
I think honestly, and I mentioned this to you, I don't know when it was, Kenny, because I did a little bit of a rewatch of Entourage many, many moons ago, and I was texting you about it. And like, the show is a lot better than anyone gives it credit for, but I also understand why it was sort of kicked around a little bit at the time. Like, it's just an interesting thing. All that being said, we're here to talk about The Adventures of Sebastian Cole today. I'm going to give a little bit of context for the people that maybe
three, one of like three pre-Entourage movies that Adrian Cole kind of.
What was the
Adrian
other
one? Cole.
Adrian Cole. What was the other one? Was it the
other 99 flick that he did?
Drive Me Crazy. Yeah. There's this.
I don't know what the other one is.
And Harvard Man is the other one.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it was just like Toback, I think, James Toback. And so he was somebody. He was enough. Well,
was he in the Pussy Posse?
No.
It seems like he should have been.
I don't know why I thought he was.
Well,
you know why I think he is?
Because he's in the fake Pussy Posse.
he's in Celebrity. He's one of DiCaprio's friends in Celebrity, the Woody Allen film. And I think that like my brain sort of has just projected him into the actual Pussy Posse.
In real life, God loved Leonardo DiCaprio. In real life, there was nobody in the Pussy Posse, even 100th as good looking as Adrian, aside from Leo.
You don't think Tobey Maguire's
hot? Whoa.
Come on now.
Cider House rule stands are just rioting right now.
It was nothing but skinny F boys. Like that's just gotta be the crew.
No, 100%,
but,
for sure.
And Harmony Korine and David Blaine is pretty good looking.
Insane. So The Adventures of Sebastian Cole is about Hank, played by Clark Gregg, marries the divorced Joan, who's the mother of teen Sebastian, played by Adrian Grenier, and Jessica. But after living with his new family for years, Hank suddenly announces that he's getting a sex change operation. The family then deserts Hank, with Jessica going her own way and Sebastian staying with his mom, but Joan becomes an alcoholic, so Sebastian moves back in with Hank, now Henrietta, who turns out to be far more supportive than anyone else. The Adventures of Sebastian Cole opened on August 6th, 1999, against The Sixth Sense, The Blair Witch Project, Runaway Bride, and The Thomas Crown Affair. So just getting absolutely fucking massacred. It would go on to make about $100,000. It has 46% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics.
Or what Adrian used to make an episode. Just
kidding. <Hey-o.
laughs> But what's interesting, 46% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 70% from audiences. That's a pretty significant discrepancy.
I'm so glad you caught that because I'm
surprised. Like, what? Who are these like Sebastian Cole stands that are like, I don't know.
Who are the 46 critics?
Here's the thing. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 stars. Said out of 4, The Adventures of Sebastian Cole is a coming-of-age movie that puts a new spin on some of the challenges faced by sensitive teenagers. It's not unusual to have problems with the stepfather, but it's fairly rare for the stepfather to announce that he has decided to become a woman. It's also rare for a movie to show a teenager who needs guidance and a parent willing to provide it. The fathers of most movie teenagers are absent, stupid, or cruel. Sebastian's wise and loving, first as Hank, then as Henrietta. The movie movie might have developed along predictable lines as a sitcom about coming of age with a transsexual parent, but it avoids easy and cheap shots and actually grows more perceptive and thoughtful until at last we're drawn into the simple human level. These people are worth knowing. Sure. So Todd Williams, the writer director of this film, would go on to make a film that I actually saw because I love. He did. It's a strange thing. So there's this book by John Irving called A Widow for 1 Year. It's one of my favorite books. Todd Williams adapted the first third of that book into a film with Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger called A Door in the Floor.
A Door in the Floor.
Which is a solid movie. But outside of that, and then he did, I think, the second Paranormal Activity. You know, because that...
I did the research, guys. I did the research. Yes.
We appreciate that. We appreciate that.
Then you also know that's the bad one.
Is it the bad one? What makes it the bad one?
It's just boring. It's a rehash of the first one. The first one's amazing. The third one is like too good to believe, frankly.
Sure.
It's
the second one is like, just do that again.
Yeah, the second one is Do That Again. The third one is like, I don't know, like it's the guys who did Catfish. It was their first like scripted movie. They're just like, we're going to do everything we can to not be like embarrassed by this. And they were really clever. I really liked the third one. But
So the movie that this weirdly reminded me of at times was Rushmore. Did you guys get a Rushmore vibe from this a little bit when he's like riding his bike through the halls?
It's the school uniform. I also, just before we go on, other bit of research. The Door in the Floor, the Jeff Bridges character, also last name Cole. So I don't know if that's a thing.
Interesting.
Got a Cole fixation. It's probably a John Irving title all that he brought, from, brought over Kevin from. Cole, yeah. But anyway. I totally got that. And also, like, maybe random Easter egg of the movie, I got Garden State. Scene where he shoots the arrow into the that's another note. Garden State, all caps, exclamation point.
I think this movie's
the only time that's Garden written State. In people's notes
is it's better than Garden State.
I think it's about as good as Garden State.
Wow,
I think like
really
I think Garden State's pretty bad now. Like I really did like it in, what was it, 03 when it came out, 04? But I returned to it, you know, when I was writing something that I thought it was relevant for, and kind of couldn't believe how inept I thought it was.
I would still say the they both great, aged but... poorly and had pretty good soundtracks for the movie.
I agree.
I'm going to ride a little bit for Garden State here. The smallest amount, more than you guys, only insofar as that... first of all, I think the music's better in Garden State, but that's neither here nor there.
100%.
The music is excellent in that movie, so I don't mean to hit on it.
Despite the fact that like Zach Braff has proven himself to not be a particularly good director, that movie actually kind of has a vision, whether or not you're on its wavelength, whether or not it's fair. Working for you. It worked for me in 2002 or 2003 when I was like, in my early 20s, and I was like, this movie's a masterpiece.
And it hit the zeitgeist in a very real way. Yeah. Like there's like it touched Livewire, and for like 5 years, like there are not many movies that for like a 5-ish year period, people are just like, that's amazing. So
I'm with you. It's not a lot of fun in 2022 where we are to hate on Garden State at this point. I think everyone kind of knows.
It's easy.
It reminds me a little bit. I just saw Vengeance. I told you this film, the Vijay Novak movie. Novak. And it only reminds me of that movie in that those are two guys who I root against very hard.
Oh my God, 100%.
Yeah, yes, right?
He's the worst.
Those guys are both like the biggest. No, I'm not talking about the characters. I'm talking about the humans. The humans behind the movie. Yes. I root against Zach Braff and Vijay Novak, the people. And I liked both of those movies. In the moment, despite how much I didn't want them to succeed. The other thing that happened definitely was Zach Braff. I mean, and for me right now, with my BJ essence, I was really interested in what Braff was doing next. You know, like he turned me. And right now with BJ, like he's made so much shit, like frankly, where, you know, I almost feel like I don't know how Vengeance happened because it really is a very good movie.
But, yeah.
No one's to get back so hard.
No.
This is the way it goes, Matt.
I'm taking the car off the cliff, and he's
I love it so much. I will tangent to all hell is loose.
Listen, I love it.
But Matt, you've seen Vengeance, it sounded like.
I did. Yeah, I watched it a couple weekends ago.
What'd you think?
I liked the film, but thought he was a terrible character, and I am questionable about the sort of like.
Well, BJ's insufferable is the thing. Like that's unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it. Like he branded himself that guy out of The Office.
He's aware of it. Like that's part of the movie. He's like, to his credit, he does it in such a way that's not self-loathing, not like a Pauly Shore is dead kind of way. But definitely like understands that the audience is going in being like, fuck this guy.
But 100% I would say that that character in that movie is someone that like thinks he's really cool. And I think Sebastian Cole also thinks he's really cool. And that's 100%. my big memory from what, so I saw this in not in the theater.
Sure, but still, but that $100,000
was something I brought home. Yeah, I was one of the rental purchases.
One of the like, 30%.
Actually, probably not, because I brought it home from the store I was working at, so I didn't pay for it. But I definitely like watched it on DVD when it came out. And like the only thing I didn't remember anything about the Transparent or like all the important stuff. But I did remember just like thinking Adrian Grenier was kind of cool. That was my big takeaway from the movie. When you emailed me and were like, do you want to do this movie? I was like, oh yeah, it's the one where like Adrian Grenier was kind of cool and like kind of a badass. And man, that was not the whole thing.
I, you know, what's interesting too, I agree with you 100%. I'll also to piggyback on that. I think Todd Williams thinks that Sebastian Cole was cool, which is maybe the most damning thing that you can say about it. It's one thing that like Adrian's playing the role, I think, to the best of his ability. But I want to rewind real quick for a second about what you were talking about with Garden State, because I think it's worth noting that like Garden State is one of the first, like maybe not one of the first, but it's in that early kind of Fox Searchlight thing. Right. When like Searchlight was starting to brand itself a little bit as the indie darling, we're going to go to Sundance, we're going to buy Sundance movies, we're going to buy Good Girl, we're going to buy, you know, Garden State, whatever. Right. And then this movie is one of the early Paramount Classics titles before they get Paramount Vantage down the road. But it's like, it's just interesting how in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, you had all of the studios building those independent arms. You had Warner Brothers had like their little independent, they all had their own little pockets of these independent things. And I can understand why, you know, this is the year after Rushmore. I can understand why you pick up a movie like this thinking, oh, we've got another like young auteur with a cool hip vibe. And it's all like doing a weird coming of age thing. But unfortunately, like, genuinely don't understand the tone of this film. The bookends of this movie baffle me. Like, it starts really like weirdly dark and moody. It's got this spooky music. We see him all bloody. We see this woman, you know, taking care of his wounds. And then, you know, obviously to jump ahead, the end of it, we come full circle and it just ends with him like running away to like funny music or something like that. Like, how the fuck did he get from this to like, It's such a false in media res that it's, you know what I mean? Like, it really, that kind of, that maybe annoyed me the most. Because that
might as well have been a freeze frame. Like,
it was a freeze frame.
Yeah, it was. Oh, God.
Sorry.
Yeah. What movie that we've done this reminds you most of?
Oh, are you asking me, Kenny?
Yeah, I think there's an obvious answer.
I apologize that I don't know what that is.
Significantly better than this movie, in my opinion. And also, in my opinion, significantly less ambitious. You got it, Matt?
No, I'm very curious.
Let's hear it, Kenny.
Outside Providence.
I buy that. Sure, 100%. Sure.
Yes, felt a lot like Outside Providence to me, and which I love.
Yes, you do.
And one, Outside Providence is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, and two, the film doesn't seem to think that the main character is cool, but the main, but the people within the world kind of like hope that they're cool. And I mean, the other movie that's kind of like this, that is a abomination, is Detroit Rock City. But,
what's interesting about the Outside Providence thing, which I agree with Kenny, is that Outside Providence is a much broader movie filled with more believable three-dimensional characters.
100%. And the emotion in that movie is so pure. Yes. I mean, the emotion of this movie is I don't think this movie is quite as bad as you guys think it is. I don't think it's good, but like, the Clark Gregg Adrian Grenier relationship is
lovely,
and mature and progressive, and you know, grounded, and it's only, you know, it's only kind of, it only deals with the trans issues when other characters bring it up, and occasionally Adrian brings it up, but not in a real judgmental way, more in a jocular way, because it's never like, you know, like the other characters, like his ex-wife and the daughter, you know, basically bring it up and then say, use it as an example to say, go fuck yourself forever. Yeah. Where, you know, Adrian will say things like, you know, are you going to be cutting your penis off? But kind of in a matter of fact kind of way.
You know, it really reminded me of similar. I know you guys have done podcasts on, or like on, or you've talked a lot about 6 Feet Under. It felt progressive in a 1999 way, in similar ways as the Keith character and that, in that it's sort of like he's gay, but he's masculine, and he's a cop.
He's a cop, and he's cool.
Yeah, and I felt like they were trying to be like, well, no, he's, you know, she's trans, but she's still like can beat up a guy, and like,
well, anyway, this is sort of my big issue with the trans in this film. First of all, gotta say, Kenny, and it's worth noting, and I think we've talked about this, but like, obviously, Boys Don't Cry is for all intents and purposes sort of tip of the spear, real groundbreaking trans film, and a brilliant movie. There's just so much. If they're not talking about it directly, there's a lot of trans allegories going on in 99 that I really didn't pick up on, obviously, in 99. And as we've talked about, the truly disappointing thing is that no one took that baton really and ran with it. Like, it kind of disappears for like a decade, it feels like.
Who knows? So, I mean, not who knows. People know, you know, queer scholars know. We don't know.
Yeah.
But there, I mean, you know, there's these two kind of poles here. You have Boys Don't Cry explicitly, you know, contextually about the trans experience.
Sure.
You have The Matrix, which is, you know, allegorically, but, you know, I think everybody with half a brain realizes that it's metaphorically about the trans experience. Then you have things where trans characters are foreground, All About My Mother, and Better Than Chocolate, for instance.
Yes.
Where, you know, where we have things like that. And you have other things that are kind of softer allegories, like we talked about being John Malkovich.
Yes.
So while, and the thing that all these movies actually weirdly have in common, including this one, is the respect that's afforded to the character in question and the experience. I'm sure that there are other trans allegories in the 10-year period you're talking about that we're just not kind of, you know, dialed into.
Sure,
but the other part of it, you know, there aren't a ton of trans characters that I could think of, you know, in the next 10 years in prominent movies. I mean, you have some. I mean, what was the Chilean movie where? I don't remember, but the point being, it's, you know, it's kind of few and far between, you know, the depictions are so poor that they, you know, they made the documentary recently, the Netflix one, about how horrible it all was.
This was one of those things where I had no idea that this was even a part of this film, right? Like that this was a bearing wall of this film, really. And I think that Clark Gregg gives a very sort of heartfelt performance. I think the writing of it is, for the most part, quite genuine and grounded. There's times where I feel like, you know, I can't totally decide if the filmmaker just thinks it's quirky to have this in the film, you know, and whether or not, you know, it's with the best of intentions of trying to sort of shine a light on a community so much. And then I would also say, killing Henrietta at the end of the film, to me, was just so, first of all, you're blindsided by it. It happens off screen. Obviously, it's a gut punch to Sebastian's character, but he apparently gets over it quite quickly and quite easily. It's very,
you know, bury your gaze.
That's what I'm saying.
They just leave you with it too, man. There's no room to breathe on that news at all. It's just sort of like, oh, and by the way,
like what Doctor would do that? Yeah, like, it's all just very strange.
Well, yeah.
I guess ultimately it's what sort of is the most, it's unearned. So you really just find yourself feeling cheated, for lack of a better way of putting it, right? I've invested in this character. You've wanted me to love this character, and then you've killed this character. It's not as though, like, and I'm not saying that this would have been a good idea, but like, there's any number of ways that character could have been killed. But for her to die during her surgery feels like an indictment in and of itself in a weird way. So like, there's just stuff that's just not great.
If I was feeling less generous, I don't feel like the movie supports this reading. I really don't believe that the movie supports. No. I just don't believe the movie supports the reading that it is in any way, kind of warning against or prophesizing against.
I don't mean to suggest that it is.
I don't think you are either. I do think that even the depiction of that is a little third rail-ish to me.
Right.
But I don't think that's what the movie is supporting. I do think the movie is using a character, a trans character, as a plot device, so our straight white boy can experience
learn
something
and grow.
He wants to be a writer, right? So
100%. It very much felt like So I watched this with my wife. And at some point in time when they were talking about him wanting to be a writer, she said, he doesn't even own a fucking moleskin. Like he's the quintessential MFA guy that wants to be a writer, but doesn't actually want to be a writer. He just wants to like be Hemingway. And he literally calls out Hemingway. And it just felt very much like, I don't know much about this director and what he's done afterwards other than Door in the Floor, but very much like, and obviously the other film that I saw of his, Door in the Floor, is about a writer who is like living with his professor who he thinks is godlike. Like, just like, oh, I'm going up and absorbing these like weird quirky experiences, and it just felt very much like that. Like,
well, as Kenny and I can both attest, there's nothing more interesting than the writing process. Everyone wants to watch a movie about a writer or a television.
I'm sure
you've
both written countless pilots. I've written a couple of short stories.
It's all
myself.
We do. I do think that it's
all writers do. God, we're so lame and boring.
It's just thinly veiled stories about our own writing. Look,
genuinely, the least visually interesting profession there is. And how many movies are about writers?
For Wonder Boys.
Wonder Boys over and
give
over
me the movie about the writer not writing. Because what Wonder Boys is about, right? Wonder Boys is about the writer not writing, and that's
adaptation is sort of about a guy not writing as well.
Yes, yes.
But I think it's worth noting too that, and I it really kind of set my teeth on edge with this too, is the trope of I want to be a writer but nothing's happened to me yet. I need something horrible to happen to me, and then of course something horrible will happen to them by the end of the film, and then of course they blossom into a brilliant writer. What's unfortunate about it?
I'd take bets that he didn't. Like, I would take solid bets that he didn't.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that.
Adventures of Sebastian Cole, and the only adventure is about his stepmother.
For sure.
Josh Radner made a movie. Josh Radner, in his I Want to Be Zach Braff phase, which I don't think has ended.
Liberal Arts? Was that what it was called?
Yeah. Made a movie where he was a writer to whom nothing has happened. And he's like, I have good parents, and I was upper middle class, and I never missed a meal. And how could I be a good writer if nothing's ever happened? Good question.
Make it up. That's what being a writer is.
Literally all, the job.
Yeah, I know. That is the backstory of almost every fantasy writer. It's like J.R.R. Tolkien was like a little English schoolboy, who just had no friends and loved dragons, but.
And incest,
yes, and his mummy, yeah.
It's unfortunate. It doesn't feel like there's also a part of me too that's like, I watch a movie like this, and I also feel like there are studio notes, even though this is an independent film for all intents and purposes. But sometimes you feel like
Sometimes you give yourself studio notes.
Right. Where you're like,
I'm not kidding.
Well,
sometimes you give yourself the like, Phil, we're doing it right now. You know, and the thing we work on. Like sometimes you're like, well, is this going to, is this the kind of thing they're going to buy? Is this the kind of thing we're going to buy? Yep. Yeah,
it's so I do want to talk very just briefly about the supporting cast and some of the cameos in this movie. You've got Femke Johnson popping up for one scene. Merritt Weaver. Yes. Yep. Merritt Weaver killing her two scenes.
All caps, all exclamation points in my notes.
Getting a little kiss action. But when she showed up, I was like, wait a second. Is that like I had to? It's like her third credit. Mm-hmm. She looks so young. Mm-hmm. She's just, you can just tell the camera loved her from like the jump. Like there's just something so watchable about her. And the scene where they do whippets basically, yes. and then he sprays her with whipped cream and tries to kiss her. And she's like, my friend's into you or whatever. And it shows that, hey, Sebastian sucks. He's a shitty guy. But she's great in that scene. She absolutely kills it. Gabriel, I think it's Mock. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
Yeah. With the Mocked of
Suits fame shows up as a deeply homophobic asshole in this film.
Is it the guy that gets punched in the terribly choreographed fight scene?
Very bad fight. You're talking about Joe the blue collar band.
Okay. I'm talking about his girlfriend's boyfriend, his sister's boyfriend. Who like drives him like 10 feet and then kicks him out of the car for no reason.
Yeah, that is a wild fight, though, that you alluded to.
It's one of the worst punches
you've ever seen.
It's genuinely
at the batting cage.
It's like Godard Alphaville level of. Sorry, it's topical because you're RIP, but.
Yeah, it was a crazy bad
film studies fight. Degree, guys.
There, I'm telling you. Love it.
No, that's good.
It was bad. The scene at the batting cage was terrible. Sebastian's frosted tips. A lot of fun there with the hairstyling.
Oh, yeah.
I don't completely understand why he rides a bicycle and then a motorcycle through his school at either point, other than that.
Did he ride the motorcycle through the school?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, man, and I guess the writer director was like, wouldn't it be cool if I guess? I don't know. It's so Wes Anderson-y in a bad way.
Yeah, it was the Wes Anderson-y, like, I'm going to throw on the 60s deep cut, and yeah.
But it definitely wasn't ripping off Rushmore. The timeline just doesn't work.
I agree.
So, you know, yeah.
Maybe Bottle Rocket? I don't know. But I know what you're saying. You're not wrong, Kenny. It's square in the middle of before Wes was really a thing. So
that's right, yeah.
Yeah, it is just a weird movie that thankfully is only, as we mentioned, like, 94 minutes long, but feels long, which isn't a good thing, obviously. But yeah, I mean, I guess my question, Kenny, is, and this comes to you, because this is, I want to just pivot back to Adrian for a quick second.
I don't regret doing this podcast. No.
No, I don't. No, I wasn't suggesting that. That wasn't my question to you. I was coming full circle on this specific episode of the podcast with Adrian. Is Adrian a good actor?
Pass. I'm kidding. I think this is the best that he's been.
Yes.
In the things I've seen him. Yes. I think Entourage called for a little bit of vacancy.
Yes.
He was meant to be, you know, a little tofu-ish. I think that when we were 8 seasons of that show. And he was called on to do things that I don't think that Adrian or Vince were really ready to do. And that hurt him. And he had to be in scenes with some serious actors often. Mm-hmm. And none more so than Jeremy, who, you know, everyone knows his shit, but an A++ when it comes to acting. He is remarkable to me.
Listen, the guy steps up. He stepped up on Entourage, and I don't mean to suggest that he doesn't. And I asked that question. It wasn't a rhetorical question. I don't think Adrian Cornet is a bad actor, just to be clear. It wasn't a leading question. I really do think that he's very charming. He's very watchable. I think that, you know, Kenny and I, and as have you, Matt, we've all been on set, right? And we've all seen people act. And then you watch it on a screen afterwards, and sometimes they transcend that medium and sometimes they don't, right? And we forget what it's like to be, how hard it is to be believable on camera. Like that in and of itself is a real talent.
And the other thing that, you know, I don't think people who aren't involved with the industry can appreciate is how much the production does or doesn't do for an actor. 100%. You know, and I mean, just anecdotally, Step Up went from YouTube Red to Stars. And the first episode just came out, and I watched the first episode on Stars. And these actors who I thought were doing bad CW on YouTube Red are now doing good premium. And it's not because these actors are any better or worse. It's just because the entire apparatus now is first of all, there's more money in it. Our directors are excellent now. And we have people who really, you know, who really care about lighting the scenes, how to like shooting the scene, shooting the shit out of the scenes, and particularly putting money on the screen. And everybody just looks so great in this version of the show. So yeah, I do think that actors really need to be given. And on top of that, they're doing 50 takes, and the director is randomly choosing which one's the best or the editor. So I think actors really need to be given like as much leeway as possible when it comes to each individual performance in terms of whether or not they're a good actor or not. You know, conversely, I always think acting awards are the strangest, weirdest things in the world.
I mean, it never ceases to amaze me when I'm on set and someone delivers a line of clunky, shitty expositional dialogue that I'm being forced to write by a studio or a network, and they make it sing. And it is a talent that I respect the hell out of and thank my lucky stars for a lot of the time. And I think that I was watching this film just thinking about what you were talking about, Kenny, of like the transition of going from film to television, but trying to portray a movie star within a television show. Like there's a bunch of weird boxes that need to be checked by Adrien Grenier's performance in Entourage. And then I actually don't think he's terrible in Devil Wears Prada. It's just a pretty thankless role.
He's okay.
But he's cute in it. He's fine.
And Clark Gregg, by the way, is the other person who I'd be like,
yes,
you know, this like you have to remember that the guys and women and people playing, you know, cop number six,
yes,
are all excellent actors in the real world. They are all as good at acting as your 13th man is at basketball, which is so much better than you will ever be. You know, that's part of what I saw with Clark Gregg, which is like he's kind of a name, but only because he lucked into this random ass fucking Marvel role. But he is a great fucking actor,
and he was great,
and not a bad writer,
honestly. Yeah,
and also
he
not a bad writer.
He's a writer.
I like he wrote What Lies Beneath.
What?
Yeah,
I just rewatched that like a week ago. That's blowing my mind. Yeah. That's blowing my mind.
He co-wrote it, and I believe he also wrote and directed an adaptation of Choke, the Chuck Palahniuk
thing. I remember that.
Yeah, which I don't remember loving, but like again, Chuck is a tough person to adapt. But yes, Kenny's not. He's absolutely right. I think that Clark Gregg kind of, you know, weirdly sort of, I don't want to say stumbled, but like was given this role that turned into something far more significant as the Marvel universe expanded.
Supposed to be dead.
Yeah, he's supposed to be dead.
Well, and to your point, Phil, like this role that he was in this film could have been a very thankless, like one dimensional play if in the wrong hands. And he really made it feel genuinely sympathetic, which was pretty. He was the bright shining light of the movie, despite the fact that it's the adventures of Sebastian Cole.
But. Yeah, it's. I agree with you 100%. I think that there are far lesser actors who would have taken a role like this, thinking, "Oh, this will get me. You know, this will get me noticed, right?" And not approaching it with the level of humility and sort of, a genuine groundedness. I think there's a lot of actors that would have either played for the cheap seats or would have been embarrassed to play the role, and you would have felt that embarrassment, and none of it is felt with Clark. You get the impression that Clark Gregg loves Henrietta, and wants you to love her too.
He even hit on that too in his review. It was kind of like he played it like a real person, which is surprise. Wow.
And you get the sense.
Yeah.
You get the sense that he probably, I mean, again, don't know, but the sense that he actually probably hung out with real people who experienced this versus some other portrayals by cis men of trans women that just feel a little more like this is how a trans woman might act on a show.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anyway, so here we are. Let's rate this, Kenny, shall we? Do you want to go first?
Rate this. Sure. Unlike Matt, I had never seen this movie before. So
I'm like
I can't do my 99 rating.
No.
But as you know, Matt, I haven't seen any movies. So this is not weird. This movie, I was gonna give it like a gentlemanly 40.
Yeah.
And I'm still like, I'm going to drop it a little bit because I think I did kind of convince myself that the death of Henrietta is horrible. And it's horrible. And it's like, I don't know if that, and granted only 12 people saw this movie, but if that dissuaded one trans woman from having their, you know, their gender affirmation surgery, then yeah, this is a really bad thing. So I'm going to go down just a little bit. I don't think it's a terrible movie. I think its heart is in the right place. I think it was like a good effort also in its own way.
I agree.
Just go to like a 37. That seems a little mean. I'm going to go to 39. 39.
I mean, so I guess I like this movie more than you, Kenny, weirdly. But I mean, so I came into this at a 57.
Oh,
down to a 52.
More than me.
Okay.
I don't think the
recommendation threshold.
Yeah, I didn't want to drop below 50 because there's a part of me that's like, as much as I, you know, as I mentioned, have a real problem with Henrietta's death, I do think that Clark Gregg's performance really is worthy of, you know, recommendation. As we've said, you know, in the course of this episode, it's not a good movie. I've gotten a lot of issues with it, but at its core, I do think that that central relationship between Sebastian and Henrietta is really sweet. It brings out the best in both the actors. I feel like the scenes that they have together are the best scenes in the film. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm at a 52. That's where I'm at. What about you, Matt?
Oh man. As someone who was one of the 15 to see it, probably 2001. Like I said, my main takeaway was, wow, Adrian Grenier is really cool. I think but I wasn't like, obviously I didn't love it enough to remember the core tenet of the film. So it was probably like a 60, 65, somewhere in there. But man, watching this, something we didn't hit on and we don't need to belabor it, but like there was a lot of 1999 homophobia
tons.
Hitting hard, and I know that's just a problem with the era, but man, it just like everyone just felt very personal about this transition. Like, you know, people that were friends of friends. And so like I think this conversation actually warmed me a little bit because it did remind me that like I think the heart was in the right place, and I think some of the actors that were involved really like took it earnestly and like did their best, but I still, like probably like a 35. It's a pretty solid.
I guess I'm the only one riding Sebastian's motorcycle.
I didn't see that coming.
I didn't see it coming either. I don't know. I here's the other thing that should be said too, and I'm sure, you know, our listeners and Kenny can attest. I mean, I'm a bit of a sucker for a coming of age movie.
Fair.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it always just kind of, I don't know. I'm always willing to kind of give it more rope than it deserves.
It's a nice movie. I think we've done it. We've done a bunch of the movies kind of in this, you know, milieu. Like
Adventureland comes to mind a little.
Like an event. Well, like a new Waterford Girl.
Yes.
You know, movies kind of in this budget level and this kind of vibe. And you tend to like them a little more than me in general.
I do.
Yeah,
the
hair, but yeah.
Yeah, I think there's, I don't know. I'm a sucker for just like, I don't know, that sort of that time in your life where firsts feel so significant and everything is just sort of seismic. You know, and I think that filmmakers tend to gravitate towards it because they obviously love to romanticize their upbringings
for sure.
To some degree or another.
Right, Matt, before we let you leave, mm-hmm. you mentioned that Eyes Wide Shut's one of your top three of 99. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if
let's hear the top of
your head and had your other two, or if there's any movie that you wanted to like highlight.
Do you have any others that jump out? There need to be ways. Yes. You know.
I mean, it's really tough. Eyes Wide Shut is definitely up there. I'm mm-hmm. a huge sucker for Magnolia for sure.
Sure.
Who isn't?
Yeah, who isn't? Yeah. Jerks. I mean, I don't know if I could pick a third. Like, there's just so many. The conceit of this whole podcast is brilliant because it's just such a, there's so much stuff. Like, I mean, this is not credit to you, Phil. I appreciate the, but no, it's just like, it was a great year for movies.
It's
like,
not a credit to either of us.
Really. Not you guys. I mean, we didn't make any movies in 1999, but no, there's just so many good things.
I did make a movie in 1999.
Did you?
Yes. It was very
I made a short film too. But yeah.
It was called.
Are those on YouTube somewhere that we?
I wish they would be because it was really good. Maybe my friend Phil Gerard has it. It was called Two Dumb Aliens Go to the Fair.
Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
It was a good movie.
Yeah.
And I don't even want to get too into it. Hopefully, we'll just put it up on YouTube one day. But basically, two dumb aliens go to the fair.
I'll say
that for the Patreon members.
Basically, what happened was in the movie was it was about two dumb aliens. They're at Burger King. We shot it in black and white. Having a conversation about going to the fair. They go to the fair. The fair is not there. The fair has moved. The movie stops, starts over with the scroll. We had a scroll before, a crawl.
Crawl.
And then the only difference was now said two dumb aliens don't go to the fair. And we played the same scene again.
Oh my.
And doing the same end. It was high school. We were really proud of it.
That's amazing. Yeah. We have a, without saying who it is, I'll tell you when we're off mic, Matt, but we have someone coming on who did direct some short films in 99 that I hope maybe we'll be able to get access to so we can talk about those. But yeah, it's interesting. 99 was a great year. So any others that jump out at you, Matt? I mean, Magnolia,
Two
Dumb Aliens is definitely like top tier for sure. Malkovich is up there for sure. I mean, and then there's just like, you know, I guess it's because, yeah, I mean, 99, I was sophomore in high school, so like so much stuff that's bad. I mean, I'm a ride or die for Cruel Intentions, Kenny, like 100.
There you go. Man.
But so many things that are like now I watch them like this is terrible, but like in the moment was, you know, like the American Pies of the world, like all that stuff like just hit very well for me. But I feel like 99 was the year where I was like, movies are a thing. It was like the first time I felt the Oscars on an emotional level and you know, like all that stuff. So like there's so much good fun stuff. I mean, I could rattle off like all of them.
No, for sure. You know, it's, I'm curious, Kenny, as we get to the end of this and before we do our 52 in review at the end of all of this, I think I'm going to go back and watch some of the early ones again. Cause I feel like, I mean, 5 years is a long time and there's a part of me that's sort of like, there are some films that I loved that we did in year one that I'm just sort of like year five and four and five are so fresh in my mind that I kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like, cause like when like Cruel Intentions, for instance, is a movie that I'm like, I want to watch that again. I feel like I don't know. It was a great episode, but I'm just sort of like, there are some stuff that I want to refresh.
There are two, I think I'm definitely going to watch again. Do you want to guess what they are?
Oh man. Well, one of them, I feel like might have to do with our guest that I'm, I don't know if you know what I'm referring to.
Oh, it actually does. Yes.
I think that's when I'm probably,
I will watch that again, not because of that guest, but because I felt like I was flexing too hard on it for no reason. And
you'll understand in a sec, Matt, when we tell you.
I want to get back to my roots on that one. The other one that I want to watch again.
Yeah.
Because it comes up on this podcast on an almost fucking weekly basis.
Yes.
Is Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yes.
Because that's another one. It's so good.
I'm starting to wonder like if maybe Ripley's like a top 10. Yep. And I don't like, I really loved it, but we watched it early in the pod. Yeah. I don't feel like I had a lot of things to compare it to in that moment.
Yeah.
And, God, people really love that film. So I think I have to watch it. I have to watch it again and, like, you know, kind of prime myself, or maybe I'm watching a top 10. So
Jude Law is incredible. And yes. I worked on a movie when I was in college. The Louisiana. Oh God, I can't even remember the name. Sean Penn.
Okay. Oh yes. All the President's Men, all the King's Men.
So I worked for like a week as a PA on all the King's Men. And I saw briefly James Gandolfini and Jude Law on the same day. It was like
the two most beautiful men.
Jude Law genuinely had a glow, like, just what an incredible, like, superhuman person.
It's been said many times online, but, like, Dickie Greenleaf is one of the most beautiful things that's ever been on.
We were on that one from the start. Yeah, we knew that coming into it.
It's absurd, but the movie is fantastic.
Yeah. It really is. And I also say, too, today somebody just tweeted about Philip Seymour Hoffman's entrance in that film being one of the best entrances ever.
Yeah, he's awesome. Is that the singing?
He comes in on the red Corvette convertible, and he's like, and the women are walking by, and he says, "Don't you want to fuck every woman you see just once?" Like, he's great. Now. This was amazing, Matt. We're so thankful that you came awesome, on. Matt. This was a blast. As people know,
not to put pressure on the other people, but you know, they're supposed to
they be got a lot to live up to now.
And we're on like minute 50. I don't know.
I'll say this. So this episode for our listeners' edification, and maybe for yours too, Matt, I don't know if I told you this or not. They're all going to be, all these four mini episodes are going to be put into one episode. So
one now one 4 hour episode.
It's going to be a four hour episode.
Sorry.
You're the first one out of the gate. This was a blast. We had so much fun talking to you, and we thank you so much for listening to us yammer on for 5 years about all sorts of good, bad, and, you know, pretty forgettable films. So it's been an absolute blast. So we really do appreciate
that. Thanks for taking on the most forgettable of them all.
Oh no, thank you. I wish I had remembered it more before I signed up for it, but hey, we got through it.
We did pick this one.
35 of the 50 minutes not talking about the movie, and that's probably for the best. So
that's the way it should be. Yeah. But thank you so much for coming on, Matt.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 face down on a pool table here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And with us today is our friend, friend of the pod, great Twitter presence, and an all-around great guy, Jackson Bourne. So nice to meet you, have you on the pod. You really are very good at Twitter.
You are very good at Twitter.
Thank you. It's nice to meet you guys too. That's where I have fun and where I connect with, you know, other movie fans and people who are, you know, into these niche little things like me. I mean, I feel like I know you guys already, understandably. So now we get to kind of, you know, level the playing field, and you can learn a little bit about me too. So
tell me about yourself. Yeah. What do you want us to know?
Well, I mean, I'm one of those people that sort of traffics in nostalgia, as you can probably tell on my Twitter feed. So that's just one of those things that I connect with other people on. So when I discovered your podcast, let's see here, in like 2018, it was just right in my wheelhouse. Cause everything was connecting. I love that you guys were completists. After all, we are doing In Too Deep.
Yeah, that's right.
This is not the best Omar Epps movie of 1999. It's not the best LL Cool J movie of 1999. It's not even the best Nia Long movie of 1999.
That's true. But is it the best Stanley Tucci movie of 99?
I don't know.
What did he do in 99? Why am I drawing a blank?
Midsummer Night's
Dream. So no, it's not. It's not.
Yeah.
But I think it's better than the other movie we did with the Tooch.
I was going to say.
Lovely Bones.
Lovely Bones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. This is the second LL Cool J film we're doing with Deep in the title.
True.
So that's a thing. Mm-hmm. He's better in Deep Blue Sea. Would you say, Kenny, he's better in Deep Blue Sea? Kenny would definitely say he's better in Any Given Sunday. That's for
course. Sure. Yes, he's better. Actually, he's amazing in Any Given Sunday.
He is.
He really is incredible. Yeah. And also, he's much better in Inch Deep. He's not good in this movie.
No.
He's poorly cast. This movie isn't bad though.
This movie isn't bad. I actually think I brought it up to you because you watched it obviously before me, Kenny, and I was like, how is it? And you were like, it's actually not bad. Like, it's not. It's so I went into it at least knowing
it gets the job done.
It gets the job. Mm-hmm. I think that LL Cool J is miscast because, first of all, I think he's trying a little too hard. Like, I think he wants to show his
yes, without question.
Right.
It's like his first big, you know, stepping outside of being a side character or like a comedic relief. He's getting to be the villain and choose some scenery. And I think he took that, you know, opportunity of being above the title for the first time, really, you know, as a lead.
Sure.
And just ran with it and maybe went a little overboard in some of the scenes.
He's just, I mean, I don't, for me anyway, he's just too nice a guy. He radiates nice guy. Do you know what I mean? Like, and that's not to say that there isn't depth to that and range to that, because I think that in Any Given Sunday he's not a quote unquote good guy in that, but he's still sort of charismatic and he kind of does what he does. In this, I just quite frankly just didn't buy him as this type of guy. You know, as we alluded to at the beginning of the episode, there's this sort of, I would say maybe the most infamous scene, or the scene that was kind of the most harrowing, is this pool table sequence that wasn't even in the script, that LL Cool J was the one who actually like brought up as a thing to show, you know, how villainous and terrible this character was. And I'm just terrible at it.
I think it was supposed to be like this thing that showed you the lengths that he would go to really like emphasize his villainy. Because
a pool key's worth.
Yeah, this is his like childhood friend that he's, you know, essentially murdering on a pool table with a pool cue, and it's almost set up like the Reservoir Dogs, like cutting the ear off scene, like some shock value just inserted in the middle of this.
Yeah, it's really just it really stands out because of how nasty it is, and it doesn't actually make his
for those of you. I'll go ahead and say it.
Please go for it.
He essentially sodomizes a character to death with a pool cue,
and then they tell us that he didn't die, but then he does die.
Yeah,
yeah, so and it's his best friend. It's like like his kid's godfather.
Yeah,
that he does it to.
Yeah,
and it's like it sucks. It actually is a very bad moment in the movie, because it also kind of, you know, it privileges Omar Epps' character, right? So Omar Epps' character in that moment is supposed to, you know, that's supposed to be the warning sign, the warning shot against this character. Omar Epps is essentially Donnie Brasco of this movie, right? He's essentially, you know, the cop who's undercover with the mob. But in no way do I believe that LL Cool J is putting Omar is doing this to his best friend.
Yeah.
In order to show this other guy who has, you know, virtually no, you know, history in the game outside of what's been made up, that this is how serious I am about it. So it does seem like this, knowing what you guys said about how it wasn't in the script and LL Cool J kind of requested to put it in there or pitched it or whatever, it does seem it really undercuts the narrative of the film.
It really does. And it's you know, I would say that my biggest issue with this movie might actually be Omar Epps, who I like as an actor, but is kind of flat in this. He just doesn't fully connect in the way that, like, I know that what he's trying to radiate is obviously, per the concept of this film, like a man who's conflicted, right? A man who's being sort of pulled into two different directions. And he's trying to convey that, and yet for whatever reason, it's just not playing. I don't know if you guys felt the same way.
Yeah, I felt like, especially because we've seen Omar Epps do so much better in something like Juice, where he's having to play opposite of this electrical performance with Tupac, and then trying to come back and do the same thing here. And I know he's going all out. He's really trying to play these two, you know, conflicting sides of the character, but the script is really underserving him too.
You know,
he doesn't have a lot to work with.
I totally agree. Yeah. It is unfortunate that, like, it's one of those things that it's just very superficial. Like, the film never really digs beneath the surface. That's not to say that on the surface, it actually doesn't do a good job, because it does. I think this film's actually like quite competently shot. I think this movie looks quite good. I think all, you know, everyone's kind of on the bench of supporting actors. Everyone's kind of bringing their A game. I think, you know, Pam Grier and Tucci and like, there's, you know, this movie's got a pretty deep bench of really good character actors.
Hill Harper, who I thought was really good and never has been kind of right. Hill Harper got caught in thinking like the procedural world and kind of just never broke out. But like,
did you guys catch Anjanou Ellis?
No.
Yeah. No. She was the girl, the junkie that.
Oh, the other. Oh,
LL
really?
Cool J put the gun in her mouth.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
There's a lot. I mean, there's also a lot, as you can imagine, obviously with LL Cool J, there's a lot of rappers, musicians in this film. Nas is in it. Mia's in it. Like Nas. Sorry. My
no, point. No, it's Nas. It's Nas. Sorry. Nas.
It's Nas? Okay. Sorry.
It's just not Nas.
Oh, it's, you know, there's a lot of people in this that are all good. You know what I mean? Like no one is bad necessarily in this film. I think it's just the two main leads are just a little miscast. So it never fully, you know, takes flight.
I don't know if Omar Epps is, I'm not disagreeing with you that he's not exactly great. I don't know if he's miscast. He's like, to me, like perfectly cast. He just didn't bring his A game. Yeah. And LL Cool J, I understand why they went there, but there are so many guys who would, first of all, I hate the name God. I think it's silly, but there are so many guys who would have embodied that in a way that I bought. There's so many guys who could have pulled that off.
Well, I couldn't help but think about like, and this is an unfair comparison, but Denzel Washington in Training Day is sort of the, you know, the probably the apex of what you can expect from this type of
and I was thinking Ving Rhames in Pulp Fiction. Sure, so it's sure. You know, we're killing these guys and we're killing LL, but you know.
And I was thinking he was wanting his Nino Brown from New Jack City.
Yeah,
that also too. Yes,
because there was shades of that too. I mean, the thing with LL is like he was coming off of years in sitcoms already. Mm-hmm. He had, like Phil saying, he had built up this sort of warm, fuzzy, you know, comedic character and was trying to break outside of that. And, you know, he's trying to do the Frank White thing where he's, you know, serving the community at this Thanksgiving event. And then in the next scene, he's cutting out a guy's tongue. And it's just, I don't think he has the range for that.
The movie also, I know it's interesting that you mentioned that there's a sort of rat character that they cut out his tongue because he's been talking to the cops. Mm-hmm. I understand that they alluded to that, and yet I'm not entirely sure it's conveyed in the actual violence that happened. You know what I mean? Like, you're just sort of like, what just transpired exactly? And yet, obviously, they do go for it on that, on the pool table sequence. But I do want to give just a little bit of context for people that haven't seen this film. Drug lord Dwayne Gittins, played by LL Cool J, rules Cincinnati with an iron fist. No wonder he's known as God on the streets. Determined to break Gittins' stranglehold in the city, is undercover cop Jeffrey Cole, played by Omar Epps. Supporting him in the difficult task ahead is his girlfriend, played by Nia Long, and his tough-as-nails commander, played by Stanley Tucci. But as Cole takes on an assumed identity to penetrate Gittins' criminal empire, he makes a disturbing discovery. He kind of likes being a gangster. In Too Deep opened on August 25th, 1999, against The Sixth Sense, Runaway Bride, Mickey Blue Eyes, and Bowfinger. It would go on to make $14 million on a $7 million budget. This movie, like, made money. Like, I mean, I truly, you know, not a lot invested, but still, they doubled their money. It's got 39% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, but 75% from audiences, which... kind of makes sense. Like, this feels like a movie that, like, probably did really well on video and has a lot of fans in that kind of capacity. Variety said In Too Deep doesn't exactly abound in surprise plot twists. Even so, director Michael Reimer does a satisfying job of infusing the cliches with edgy persuasiveness. USA Today said it's the kind of summer movie you can see only if a PAL or failure has knocked out your air conditioning, which seems a little bit harsh.
Good reason.
I get critics not being on board with this movie. This is just sort of not a... I don't know that this movie is aiming for critical reviews.
Because it's rote, right? It really just is. It seems like it traffics way more in like Italian mafia cliches than urban gang cliches. Yes. And I don't know how well that kind of, you know, plays. I don't know how well that this movie wears that. You know, I think in 2022, you know, I think you would go a little deeper, no pun, and figure out exactly what's happening with, you know, Cincinnati street gangs and how they're doing. It's a very much a, you know, mob Don type situation with LL Cool J, which doesn't ring very true to me.
As I was watching this, I kept thinking I've seen a better version of this movie already. And I don't know if you guys will agree with me or not, but this was like deep cover for me. Sure. Like watching
deep,
like
deep cover is a good movie.
Yeah. Yes. The Lawrence Fishburne, Jeff Goldblum film.
Which is not, you know, it's not an identical plot. But there's so many themes that overlap with this, and the journey that Lawrence Fishburne's character is, it's very similar to this, but he has the ability to make it believable. It just felt like a lot of things in this that should have fleshed out Omar Epps' character were done better in that movie. And not just like the conflict within him, but the relationships. It felt like he was supposed to have a more connected relationship with Stanley Tucci to make that hit. Yeah. And he was supposed to have like a bond with LL Cool J, like how Fishburne and Goldblum have in Deep Cover.
Deep Cover. Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting because, Kenny, you alluded to Donnie Brasco, a great movie. You know, I also couldn't help but think of The Departed, a not as great movie. You know, in terms of just the suspense that's necessary based on the conceit of the film, right? Like, you have to buy into the fact that this guy's life is in danger at all times, right? And you have to buy into the complexity of the relationship with LL Cool J's character. I mean, when you look at Donnie Brasco and you know what, you know, what Johnny Depp's character is going through in terms of he's living life on the razor's edge. Even in The Departed, which I don't think does as well because it's so convoluted in all of its kind of twists and turns and what have you, you're still feeling Leo's, you know, life is in danger.
Well, and Leo's the best.
And yeah, Leo's great. And it's not even on a script level so much as it really is on sort of, it's on a direction level and it's on a performance level, and you just don't feel it.
Yeah.
I love Donnie Brasco. It's one of my favorite movies.
It's a good movie.
And, part of the reason Donnie Brasco works so well is because Pacino is so pathetic.
So good. Yeah.
And the only Donnie, it makes so much sense why he would bring Donnie into the fold, because it's like, you know, it's like an old scout trying to bring in the next, you know, young kid. Fireballer trying to, you know, have some relevancy. I don't see that same kind of dynamic here. No. And I, you know, it's pretty typical. I have another question for you guys. I think I might have said this to you, Phil, or maybe I texted someone else this. And Jackson, I think you know a lot about movies, my sense is. Have you guys ever seen a movie that was not? Yes, Phil, you have seen a movie. Phil starts to, yes, I have. Have you ever seen a movie that was about, not about undercover officers, where the people checked for a wire? Where there's some kind of meeting between two gang people, two criminal entities, and they check for a wire, and the wire isn't a plot point already. It's a little pet peeve of mine. It's just like every time the movie's about someone wearing a wire, there was like, oh, let's check out and see if there's a wire. But like, I've never seen a movie that's not about that, where like, all right, you know, this is what we do. We always check for wires. Of course.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's it.
Yeah, no, I know. No, it's true. I think the wire thing, I think to your point, Kenny, is very tropey. It's done to death. It is. I mean, sometimes it can be effective when it's kind of a throwaway thing, if that makes sense. Like, I think that the wire scene that I think about is Viggo Mortensen in Carlito's Way, when he wears a wire and he's, you know, he's in a wheelchair now, and he's just this very sort of sad person, and, you know, and Carlito, you know, discovers the wire. It that's more about just sort of the pathetic, quote unquote, patheticness of the situation. But to your point, Kenny, whenever it's like a plot point or like a thing, it just never feels real.
Yeah,
when it's just so weird, because it's just like, it's always presented in undercover movies like cops are like criminals are always like thinking like, are you going to be wearing a wire? Is this guy wearing a wire? Is that guy wearing a wire?
Right.
Where's the wire? Wire. Yeah. But
do they even wear a wire in The Wire? Does anyone even wear a wire?
Yeah, there's some
wire the entire movie. I mean, the entire series. No, I don't think there's a wire. It's too cliche.
It's too, it's hat and a hat.
It's been done.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this movie, I mean, it's very much a product of its time. When I hit play on this thing and that credit sequence started, I was like, oh boy, it's just this super grainy post-production filter thing they've put on some footage of, you know, street footage or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And I don't even really think, you know, coming back to the script, this whole cross-cutting between him and the classroom that kind of loops back on itself, where we sort of see him undercover. It's fractured narrative shit. It doesn't really work. It actually is not propulsive at all and doesn't really actually pull you into the film.
Though it's interesting. It could have worked. Like that,
it could have worked. Yeah.
It's a structure that I haven't seen and I really liked, like in theory.
Yeah. That whole opening scene where it was cutting back and forth, that reminded me again, I'll bring up Reservoir Dogs again, of the commode story. And just something being done better where you're cutting back and forth from the actual experience and then him talking about it in a teaching environment, which was, I just didn't feel like that was appropriate.
I think the reason that it didn't work for me, Kenny, and Jackson, is it felt like it was done in post. It didn't feel like it was done in script.
Sure.
It felt like they were like, is there some more interesting way that we can get into this movie? And they're like, we'll just kind of fuck around with the timeline a little bit. And you're just like, but it just doesn't work.
I think his wig was done in post too.
Yeah. That I was wondering if you guys were going to say something about the wigs. Cause he has like two different wigs and they're bad so wigs. Distracting.
Bad
they're
wigs.
So distracting. Bad wigs. Yeah. Not great. I felt bad for Nia Long as well. A great actor.
And she's so good.
Nothing to do in this movie.
Yeah,
it's
she really
a
is a
nothing
great
burger
actor.
Of a role.
There's like, also a line that I just laughed at where it's near the end and he's sort of Omar Epps is sort of following her after, I don't know, he sees her with some other guy. And then she says, I've been modeling all day. I'm tired. I'm just like, no one says that. No one actually says I've been modeling all day. Like it's just like, that's an insane way to put it. She's really given just the short shrift in terms of the character. But, you
know. Yeah. And the whole relationship felt sort of like a separate throwaway subplot. Like they don't really invest any time in her finding out what he does. Yeah. You just see her looking at these pictures on the wall. And then she's like, oh, they're going to pull you back in, aren't they? And it just felt like, how did we get here?
She really, I'm looking at her Wikipedia. She really works. She's really kicked around a lot, but nothing is really, they never really figured it out.
They just, it's unfortunate. It's because she is a good actor. Like I do great feel actor. Like, I would argue that the scene she has with Omar, I'm buying her way more than I'm buying him, even if they're not giving her much to do. It's just,
she got caught up playing wives and girlfriends really early,
right?
And then got kind of lost in this Big Mama's House, Are We There Yet world. Right when she should have been, you know, blasting off. Because I mean, she was really, really great at Boiler Room, really, really good in that movie. And you know, I mean, not to objectify, so pretty, and no one looks like her.
Stunning,
like just. So pretty. So I don't know.
She's great in The Best Man, movie that we did quite a while ago. But like, that's one of those movies. And we talked about this a little bit when we did the episode, Lord knows when. I think it was like 3 or 4 years ago now. But that cast is stacked. Everyone should have blown up off that movie. And a lot of people did. And that movie is a lot smarter, a lot more nuanced. It's got a lot of stuff going on in it. And there should have been more movies built in the Best Man mold that didn't, and it's
the male cast really all kind of blew up, but the female cast not quite as much.
And
I felt like she stood out quite a bit in the Best Man as like a highlight performance.
I totally agree. I think that, again, you know, sort of talking about the supporting roles, but like Jake Weber's good in this, David Patrick Kelly's good in this, like, you know, all of the supporting characters are showing up. Those actors are showing up, which I appreciated, because I think that, and it should be said too, on the casting side of things, you could have cast all those roles with basically anonymous supporting actors, and it could have just been a completely forgettable movie. And I do think that that whole bench of people elevates this thing to being something, you know, more substantive, surprisingly more substantive. I wanted to ask you, Jackson, just in terms of 1999 in general, you know, what are some of your favorite films of night before we rate this and what have you, but what are some of your 99 favorites that, I mean, not just the episodes we did of them, but the movies themselves.
Yeah. So I was 15 in 1999. Sure. So I was pretty much obsessed with, you know, like The Matrix,
sure,
Phantom Menace. I mean, that's one I've had a complicated relationship over the years. Fight Club. Sure, sure. Yeah. So, I mean, those were some of my, I actually came kind of prepared with my top five films.
Let's
of
give it. Come on, bring it.
Come on.
So The Matrix was my number one. Sure. That was one that, one of the first experiences I remember going in blind on a movie and just being blown away, obviously. The Iron Giant, what can I say? It's like one of those movies from that year that now I share with my kids, and it's one of their favorite movies.
How old are your kids?
They are 6 and 8.
Nice.
Yeah.
Did you watch The Iron Giant with your kids, Kenny? I can't remember when we did the episode.
Yeah, they weren't into it.
I had a feeling. I just wasn't sure.
Yeah, I don't think my kids have graduated to Kenny's son's tastes yet.
Rollins is out of his mind.
It's a high bar. I mean, to meet Rollins.
We watched Poltergeist last night, and he's like, I'm like, you like it? He's like, yeah, not scary.
Yeah, it's a great movie. I'd never seen it before. I watched it with Catherine recently. I'd never seen it.
Just watched it?
Like over Halloween. Yeah.
Oh, I've never seen it. I've never seen it either. It's
a movie.
Yeah.
A first half is great. It's a little too silly for me in the second half.
Well, like it gets, I mean, I just,
it's not
I
what
guess
I'm
I
looking to, for exactly, but I mean, I love how Spielbergian it is. I love how Amblin it is, sure, but it gets silly. And like, I guess I just want, I don't know. You know me. I just want to be, I want to piss my pants.
I know. I hear you. It's not scary. But I watched it. There were a couple things that hit me about it, not to make this about Poltergeist, but very briefly, I'll just say that I really loved how tactile it was. I loved all the fucking special effects. Like the special effects were fucking dope. And I was also just really kind of surprised kind of where it went to a certain degree in terms of like the marriage and in terms of the relationships within it. And then I also tried to put on my like 1982 hat a little bit. It was 82, I think.
Yep, it was 82.
And just being like, in 82, this thing must have fucking ripped. You know what I mean?
You know, like, it is really, it is really good. Like, truly, like, there's a lot of stuff in there that, like, you know, I was kind of surprised and trying to kind of explain to Rollins in the moment why, you know, why it's not, why we shouldn't hate these characters for smoking pot in bed. But
that's fucking awesome, right? Like, I love that the parents
amazing.
Are smoking pot.
It's wild. It's a great movie.
And
it's a great movie.
Book about Reagan. This is great.
I saw it a couple of years ago at a rep screening, and it was so cool to see how so many of those moments that I'd grown up seeing just on TV and to myself were still hit with an audience. You'd get those reactions and the laughs and the jumps and everything. The first time I saw Poltergeist was the worst conditions because someone turned it on in the background at like a high school party when I was in high school.
Yeah. Oh,
it was like,
yeah,
like playing in the background. I'm like, I've never seen this. I want to watch this, but this is ridiculous. This is not a background movie.
Yeah. For whatever reason. And I don't, cause I had never seen it all the way through. But for whatever reason, like when I used to go to Hebrew school, they didn't start Hebrew school until the elementary school kids got out. And the elementary school kids got out 45 minutes after the middle school kids. Okay. So the middle school was walking us to the temple. So we would walk to temple and we'd be there with about, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes or so. About 45 minutes of just sitting there and doing nothing. They'd always put on a movie. And for whatever reason, they always put on Poltergeist. So I've seen the first 45 minutes, like a lot. And I didn't even realize that Carol Ann, like kind of disappeared through the second half of the movie.
She really does. I also think like the reveal that it's built on a cemetery. Is one of those things that like, again, in 82 must have been fucking awesome. In 2022, you're sort of like, I think I know where this is going. I don't know. I just, yeah, it's one of those movies that like, I was happy I finally saw it. I really dug it. But back to your list. What was your number two? You talked about The Matrix. And then,
The Matrix was
Iron
one.
Iron Giant was two.
Iron Giant was two. Giant was my two. Third one was Phantom Menace. I know how you guys feel about that one.
Well, okay. I don't think we hated it. But...
At this point, I mean, nostalgia is doing a lot of the heavy lifting on that one for me.
Sure.
But also, I think in retrospect of what we've seen in the, you know, 23 years since, it's one of those things that I go back and watch it now, and I'm like, yeah, there's a lot of problems here, but there's a lot of things that I like that they don't do anymore in the Star Wars universe. And it feels like that weird sort of George Lucas universe in a way that the new films didn't all feel like to me. I like, I love the, you know, the Last Jedi and, you know, some of the other choices in the Force Awakens, but yeah. Anyway,
I hear that. We did that pretty early, all things considered. It's kind of amazing that we did
year
that
one.
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Year one.
But I do think that, like, I totally hear you, Jackson, that the Star Wars franchise has although Andor, for the record, if you're not watching Andor, really, really good. I'm not caught up, but it's very good. But to your point, and I think we talked about this in our episodes, Kenny, that, like, we were looking at it through the lens of what I assume was like 2018, we probably did it, something like that, of being able to kind of look at it that way. It was post Force Awakens,
but it was definitely pre-Last
Jedi, but post Force Awakens.
Yeah.
And I think that those prequels have gotten better with time. I agree with you that they've aged surprisingly well. But what's your number four?
My number four is The Limey. That was one that, you know, that was, I think that might have been the first Soderbergh that I saw in the theater, and it just kind of was history from there for me. Great. And it's aged like really well.
I agree with you.
And then my last one is Fight Club. And I think I'm, even though it's in there in my list, I'm still kind of conflicted in some of the same ways I think you guys were. Stylistically, it just pops for me in the Fincher universe, but yeah, there's things in there that I was like watching it 20 years later, I can see how, you know, there's problems, but
I think we're through, right, Phil? Don't you think we're through? Too. I think we're on the other side now, and we like it again.
Yeah,
like yeah. I do. I think we both had the same experience where we were very nervous about doing this. Certainly felt like, yeah, this is not culturally, you know, kind of something we want to stay behind. And watching it, and, you know, like frankly having like the backing of Karen Kusama helped massively.
There were a couple years there where if you were a fan of Fight Club for the right reasons, you had to be a little bit quieter.
Yep. I, you know, it's funny, I think I mentioned this on our episode, Kenny, when we had Karn on, but I have a Fight Club poster, a print of a amazing print that someone did of it, and I took it down. Like I kind of was just like, I can't be the guy that has the Fight Club poster up on his wall.
You don't want to have to have someone come into the apartment and be like, hold on, this is here for the right reason.
Yeah, you got to explain.
You know,
explain yourself.
Like, listen to me. I understand that this has been co-opted by men's right activists. That's not me. The subtext of this movie is feminist.
Sure. But it's take
people would hate you even more.
Well, there's even like, if you take a step back from the men's rights component of it too, like it's also just really bro-y, right? Like there's this kind of like, even if you're not like a fucking
It's about boys fighting.
Right? Like so I just was like, I gotta take this thing down, man. I love this movie, but like I just can't be that guy. But I hear
it's
you.
Like, it's like why I have kind of a hard, even though like I think Warrior is like kind of unimpeachably a great film, like I'm not gonna tell a lot of people that, because like ultimately it is like about boys fighting, so you know.
Right,
I don't want to stand behind it that hard.
Do you have any others you want to shout out before we rate this and wrap this up?
I mean, I do. Well, I also brought my top five episodes of podcasts. Oh, like it's 99.
Come on. Right.
You're the first person to do that. Let's hear this.
Because I was like, someone's going to come into this episode at the end of this journey. And if they haven't taken the whole journey, I wanted to give them some deep cuts.
We appreciate this.
Never been so excited.
Yeah, seriously. I'm like, let's hear it.
Well, first of all, you have Mike Natale to blame for this, because he's, you know, he's one of the people that I'm the most, aside from you two, that I'm the most happy that I've gotten to connect with because of this podcast. And he's like, you know, just do your thing, do your research, whatever.
I love that guy. I really, really do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll start from five. So five was Universal Soldier 2 with Tom Lorenzo.
Love it.
Another awesome guy I've gotten to connect with on Twitter because of this whole thing. And, you know, not a great film, and not
not
even like not even the best sequel. Like I went back. I don't know if you guys did the whole gamut of the Universal.
We didn't, but
Tom speaks very highly of some of the new ones.
He's not the only one. Like really seems like that. I think Griffin just mentioned how great the. Well, I think it's 3 and 4. The high.
Yeah, I think the most recent one was the one that I watched where Van Damme kind of takes a heel move and becomes like a villain, and it's very amazing. Yeah, it's very weird and existential. Amazing. Yeah, so yeah, you love that one. Mm-hmm. The 99 soundtracks with Jan. Oh, was awesome. Amazing. I love that episode because I love that you guys got to get into some of those. Go is one of my top 5 soundtracks of all time.
Love it. Yeah.
So, love it.
Who doesn't love the Go soundtrack?
Listen to that so many times in my life.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like one of those things that I was listening to nonstop that year. When I think back to 99, the Go soundtrack, the Fatboy Slim album, and then the Rage album were all on constant repeat. This I don't know. Also, did you guys notice this was the only soundtrack of the 3 films that LL Cool J had that year that he didn't have a song on?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
His head is like a shark's fin.
Right. I don't know why they didn't get him on In Too Deep. But two of the
my hand is like a pool cue.
Yeah. Oh no. But on that the soundtrack, I don't know if Kenny, are you more of a hip hop fan, right?
Just in general or more than Phil?
Well, more than Phil, because I know Phil.
More than Phil, I would say. In general, no. But you know, because I've worked on so many hip hop adjacent shows.
Yeah. So Quiet Storm, probably one of the biggest songs of Mobb Deep's career. This was the first appearance was on the soundtrack. That's the song that was playing during the opening credits, Phil. During those horrible opening credits.
Yeah, not great.
and then the last little nugget I wanted to add that I had forgotten about was that this soundtrack is the first actual appearance of 50 Cent on a song.
Wow.
That's like an album, a CD, something that's officially put out was this song called How to Rob that I remember hearing way back in the day, but I didn't realize it was from this soundtrack. So this was all pre Dr. Dre and Eminem.
Okay.
So that was Universal Soldier 2, the soundtracks. Mm-hmm. My number 3, of course, is Pokemon with our beloved Mike.
that is an incredible episode.
It's an incredible episode. Yeah. that was really the
birth of a star right there.
Was a moment was like, this guy's going deep, and it's amazing. Yeah,
my only regret in the whole series is that he didn't get to you in time for Wild Wild West.
Oh God! I don't know that I would have been able to do it. I don't regret that.
It's not a regret of mine.
It's not a regret of mine either. Because I think that bit would have gotten thin. I don't know. I could have done an entire episode.
It's already driven Phil completely mad.
I can't deal with it. He's lost. It drives me fucking crazy. I drove Barry Sonnenfeld crazy. Anyway,
Pokemon. Simon Says is number 2.
Oh, wow.
And this
Wait, did we have someone on for that?
Yeah,
we did.
Was it Teddy?
Teddy, yeah.
The Simon fact that you one. Guys go through like a mid-podcast reclamation of like, is this actually good?
We really do turn around on it.
it is actually good.
Kenny's like, I think I like the Rodman movie.
It really was because we came into it just being like, let's kick the shit out of this thing, and then halfway through it we start to be like, is this movie fun?
Well, I think the villain is amazing. I mean, truly amazing. I don't remember much, but I remember like from life, you know, I have no memories, no ability to make memories. But
yeah, I barely remember
that guy
either.
Killing it. And also the fat sidekick who was the druid gear or the monk gear, like they would.
But the fucking car going off the cliff and then the parachute attaching and the effects and Dane Cook's performance in that moment.
It knows what it is. It's a movie that seems
far from our worst movie.
It really is.
Oh, man. Yeah.
What's number one? Can't wait to hear.
My number one is End of Days.
End of Days.
Just
a great flick.
End of Days is a great episode. Just you and I talking End of Days.
And the fact that I went in expecting you guys to hate it. Yeah. And then there's like this maybe End of Days. The I'm kind of a Peter Himes guy anyway. So I always, you know, I went in knowing that the movie wasn't phenomenal and that it was almost maybe the wrong movie for Arnold. I don't know, but
yes,
I think that was the movie that was just sold on the log line of Arnold versus the devil. And so anyway, yeah, that was,
you know, End of Days, Kenny, we both came into, I believe we were texting perhaps while we were watching that, if I'm not mistaken. And us both being like, this movie slaps. Like, this movie is actually really good.
Yeah, it was definitely that. It was definitely like, yeah, this movie slaps. I mean, that's not something we often say, but hey, look, I love an Arnold action movie, and I think that movie really is really a lot of fun. And yeah, we've done, so, you know, I find the devil to be so tedious. And most devil movies, and we've done like seven.
A lot of devil movies in 99.
We really did.
Shit, I mean, out of it's me like, in general. But this one really plays.
Ninth Gate, Stigmata, and End of Days are the three biggies.
Yeah. Ninth Gate, Stigmata. Yeah, but also like Omega Code feels devilish.
Oh my God, of course.
And I mean, yeah, I feel like there are more.
But the devil is, as a trope, to your point, Kenny, so fucking tedious. Like, who cares? Like, the devil is not like, this is crazy. But it's a great movie. It's a really
thank you for
episode
doing that, Jackson. That was great.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Hey, Phil, Devil and Sleepy Hollow? Kind of?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's hell. There's a hellish component. Oh, yeah.
Ride with the Devil?
He's not really in it, though. He doesn't really have much to say in it.
I don't know why. I'm looking at, I put in Devil movies 1999.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've done some great flicks.
We've done, yeah. I honestly remember
Bust Till Dawn 2.
Well, though, yeah,
more vampire, sure. More vampires than devil.
That's pretty devilish.
The Rage, Carrie. Oh yeah. All right. Go ahead.
That's the devil. That's the, yeah. I do remember, because I think End of Days was 2019. I want to say maybe Halloween 2019.
That was,
because I remember we were like, we always tried to kind of put a Halloween movie in that slot. And I think that we were both like, I remember just being like, End of Days, like just kind of being like, sure. Like, I don't think either of us would win any expectations on that movie. And it just, yeah, it was, it's one of my favorite episodes too. It was a great time.
Yeah. We really did that. Just me and you, huh?
Yeah. It was just you and I. Okay. So rating this film, I didn't see this film in 99. This was the first time that I saw this movie. Kenny, I think same for you perhaps.
Nope.
Jackson, you mentioned you had seen it in the proximity of 1999.
Yeah, I saw it like the summer, like the next year in like 2000. There was like this thing. I don't know if you guys remember when Blockbuster back in the day, they'd have like a thing where you'd pay like $30 and you could rent as many movies as you want. Wow. And it was like during the summer. And I remember this was one of those movies where I was just kind of like going through. And I was like, what is this? I was like, all right. And I remember like it didn't really hit for me then. And you know, revisiting it, and I was just like, I've seen so many better versions of this, but
So I had not seen it. I came into this podcast, I came in at a 59, and I'm kind of
generous.
Yeah, maybe it is. I mean, I'm kind of sticking there. I'm going to go down a little bit. Like, I'm going to go down to like a 55. I still think that this movie, like, you know, our rules when it, or at least the way that we approach the sort of 50%, you know, line. I think this movie is better than 50%. It's barely there, but I'm kind of, that's where I'm at on it. But what about you, Kenny?
I gave it a 47 before. I guess I feel the, you know, exact just opposite. The little flip, right? Sure. The photo negative.
Yeah.
50. I'm going to go down. Like, actually talking about it made me feel like, no, there's really not much here. Like, this is like a 41. This is like your a classic low 40s to me.
That's fair. Yeah. I hear that. What about you, Jackson? Where are you at?
I think back in 2099 era, I would have given it something like a 40. Mm-hmm. Before the podcast, I think I came up a little bit because there were some things I noticed. I've seen a lot more movies since then. I can appreciate some things better. So I came up to like a 46. And I think after the conversation and hearing your guys' takes, I think I come back down to like a 40. So I think I'm just...
It's a real roller coaster. It feels
that's
right.
Where
now.
This, that's mean, where this has to live.
Yeah. It is. I got to be honest, when we sort of, you know, made our master list and this movie was on there, I was almost convinced this was a straight to video movie. I didn't know that this movie actually got like a theatrical release. This movie made money. This movie did pretty well.
Yeah.
But, you know,
there are some movies that, you know, we're not going to get to because we're just going to pretend they're straight to video releases, but no,
Kenny and I did an episode on, oh my God, what's the name of the movie?
Light It Up,
which I've conflated these two movies together in my brain basically the entire time, which is unfair.
They're both, you know, black-led movies. Yeah. They both have three-word titles. They both, you know, feel like they're you know, heavily like blue and yellow lit.
I think the titles are vague.
Are they both dimension films?
Probably.
Is Light It Up dimension?
I want to say yes.
Okay.
I think Light It Up is kind of good. I think Light It Up is kind of good. Like, it's weird. It's kind of it's kind of morally and ethically weird, but I think it's kind of fun.
Light It Up's actually
it's not as good as this movie, but almost in a Faculty kind of way.
Yeah, you know? They both have Usher.
That's why.
Yeah, are we gonna do a Light It Up podcast right now?
I mean, we kind of are doing it right now. This is our Light It Up episode as well, guys. So
okay, we did the whole thing. I'm upset that's the one
I'm bummed we lost. Winslow Boy less so, but yeah.
Winslow Boy. You know what, Phil? Do you have your ratings in there? John could just throw it in there.
Yeah,
I remember so little about Light It Up because I think I may have seen it also like on TV or something afterwards, but it was the school. The school's like on lockdown or something.
Yes.
There's like a shooting, right?
All right. So Light It Up, I gave a 47 before, really? And I might have gotten a little higher.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
See if I can find mine real quick.
Winslow Boy, I gave a I don't know how I can give this better than a 45. What's wrong with me?
Wait,
I gave it a 45. 47 for Light It Up, 45 for Winslow, but I'm pretty sure that I went down over the course of our podcast because that movie blows.
Hold on, I'm pulling up my Winslow Boy Light It Up episode. Light It Up, I remember just being just quite frankly, just more into it. I just thought like I liked the characters. I liked the kids. Yeah. Where the fuck is this thing? Oh my God.
How did I give it a 45? I hated that movie.
You really, really hate it. Here we go. Light It Up.
It's a fucking movie about a trial where they don't even show you the fucking verdict.
It's all off screen. Light It Up. I started at a 65. I went down to a 58.
All right.
And then for Winslow Boy,
I had to have gone up. I had to have.
Winslow Boy, I started at a 40, ended at a 30. Winslow Boy sucks. Don't watch the Winslow Boy. Also, yeah, David Mamet kind of sucks now too. So
you don't want it. It's a Mamet movie, but like,
yeah,
it's like one of the four Jeremy Northam movies of the year that we had to do, and just you know, just remembering why this guy has no career. But
it was Light It Up. I think honestly. You know, we talked Breakfast Club. We talked like Faculty. Like it does kind of exist in that space. It's a little too earnest for its own good, but it's, you know, it's 90s kind of whatever. But it's a solid cast. I mean, you know, why
is it before Columbine? Did it come out before Columbine?
Well, it was certainly made before Columbine.
It was certainly made. It came out after.
I wonder if it got buried.
that's quite possible.
It also is a weird, I mean, one thing I said on my thing was it's upsetting after George Floyd. So we must have done this right around that happened.
Yes, we did.
And there is a lot of like, I think there is some like police brutality.
There is.
So it's a weird.
And just, you know, treating kids in shitty ways, which isn't great. I mean, what's interesting, for what it's worth, on the Light It Up front, 39% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 75% from audiences. Very similar to In Too Deep.
Yep.
Right? Where like, I don't want to, you know, make this racial, but like, I do think that critics back in 99, they're seeing these films that they, you know, that are tagged as urban or whatever, and they're just sort of not giving them the credit that they deserve. That's not to say that In Too Deep deserves a better rating necessarily. We just talked about that, but I do think that Light It Up is a much better movie than they gave credit to at the time. But it is interesting. Like, I do think that like these films, you know, are both speaking to, unfortunately, kind of tropey perspectives of Black culture to some degree or another, and that's unfortunate. I think Light It Up does a better job of dealing with that, though.
The funny thing I was looking at in my research was Omar Epps, in an interview for this, he talks about how this movie was in development for like 3 or 4 years, and he was always attached to it. So I'm wondering if that was like he was attached to it coming off of like Higher Learning, and then the writers, sure, Paul Aaron and Michael Henry Brown, he had been, you know, working with them on it. But you know, the fact that this director, Michael Reimer, came on, I'm wondering if he was the right person to bring the script to the screen, or if the script just never would have been better with someone else. Do you guys think someone like Ernest Dickerson or somebody would have done a better?
Yeah, he was attached originally. He might have done a better job. I mean, I think that it's, you know, I think it's indicative of just a lot of things that are kind of working against this movie, mm-hmm, unfortunately. And I, you know, the Omar Epps thing that you just said, Jackson, is interesting too. You know, we've seen this before, Kenny, in all the films that we've done over the past 5 years, where like these passion projects from actors that they attach themselves to a thing that they really love, and they bring their own stuff to it, and that can break either way. You know what I mean? You can get too in your head about it. You can sort of, and I do wonder whether or not Omar Epps, maybe this project, this script, you know, he just, for whatever reason, just kind of lost something in the translation from his passions and his brain to the actual performance itself. It's just interesting. But more than anything, Jackson, this has been an absolute pleasure to yes, finally meet you, likewise, to finally put a face to the tweets.
Thank you.
To be able to, you know, your support of our podcast over the past 5 years, just, it means the world to us. So we really do.
Yeah, I appreciate all you guys have done. I'm honored that I was able to come on, even though this was not the best film of 99. I'm honored because you could have gotten someone that was more qualified. You could have gotten Guillermo Diaz, who you've already had on.
It's true. It's actually true.
Was in the movie.
He was in the movie. Yeah. And when he popped up on screen, I was like, oh, he's in this? He's in like one scene. And my God, yeah, he's so rail thin in this. Like, it's pretty crazy. So. But yeah, there was never any question. You know, when Kenny brought up the idea of us doing a fan episode, there was never any question that you were on the list. We're thrilled that you were able to, that you were able to talk about this film, that you saw this film around then. But honestly, like, you know, Kenny and I have talked about this for years now, but truly, like, the fact that anyone gives a shit about our podcast really is a miracle. And we just love people that really care. You know, it's an amazing thing. So,
yeah.
You know.
Thank you, Jackson.
Absolutely. For your
support and now your friendship.
Thank you.
And it's yes, it's really something special. So thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat with us now. And we look forward to continuing to chat. If it's not through Twitter, whatever rises from the ashes of Twitter,
it'll be on Mastodon.
Likewise.
See you on Mastodon. Thank you so much. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Later. Talk to you soon. Podcast like it.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from, is it a rave? Here in 2022, I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Felisco.
And with us today is the creator of the podcast like it's 1999. Wiki, the most important person in America to me and Phil, John Barnhill. John, thank you so much for coming on, for being a fan, for doing this for us. It is like, it is the nicest thing anyone's ever done to me, done for me. And I have four children, as you know. There are so, I don't think anybody in America knows more about me than you do, John.
I will say it got a little creepy when I was trying to research your wife, and I had to reach a point where I said, I'm not going to go any further. I'm just going to drop this.
So. That is incredible.
That job. She was on the podcast once, so she has her own page, and you know, she has a footprint on the internet. It's digital footprint.
Great episode. I mean, she was great.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's when we discovered the wiki, it was sort of
we didn't discover it. I mean, John tweeted it. Tweeted it at us, right? But yeah, I mean, but yes, yes,
yes.
Very nonchalantly, very much like, so guys, started a wiki. Yeah, you know, no here deal. It is.
Here you
take
go.
A look at it. You know, literally every episode,
we're just like, this is unbelievable. This goes deeper than we could ever have possibly imagined.
I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, it started out just for myself. Like I was keeping a spreadsheet just of the scores just for myself. And I was like, maybe other people will be interested in this. And, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I especially like Blank Check and Doughboys. Sure. They both have very extensive wikis. And I was like, nobody else is doing this. I guess this falls on me. So I had to get up and figure it out and learn how to do it. So.
God, that's cool.
It's wonderful. You know, anyone who's a listener of our podcast should absolutely check it out. It is an amazing.
You can get lost in there. You can get lost. And when you started adding, because this is the one that I really blew my mind with, Phil, when you started adding the movies mentioned.
Yeah.
That, and of course, like, I mean, as a, you know, a bit of a narcissist, I'll just go back and read the quotes and be like, God damn it, you are so funny and clever and smart, Kenny.
Amazing.
Look at you, Kenny.
Yeah, and I did that mostly for myself, just so I could go back and remember, you know, the score is one thing, but the quotes really kind of give you a sense of what you guys thought of it, really. Like if you look at Talented Mr. Ripley, like you guys gave that a relatively low score, but I think the quotes kind of indicate you felt that was higher up. And so it was just kind of for myself, like looking back to kind of reorient. And then, you know, I made a huge mistake adding the movies and TV mentioned, because now I have to go back and listen to hundreds of hours of episodes again to bring that up.
I don't know why you did that. We it's so funny because as the podcast is coming to a close, mm-hmm. Ripley's coming up almost every episode, and you're right in that I clearly if that episode had dropped 2, 3, 4 years later, we would have had higher scores. We didn't know really what we were doing with the scores then, but we our memories of that movie is far fonder than I think that score would indicate. Just yeah, like you said,
it is interesting. I mean, that movie in particular, to your point, Kenny, has come up a bunch as we've been wrapping up, and you know, as we've been doing this for a while, that's probably the one of like maybe one or two, maybe three movies that we did early on that I feel we sort of. We were still figuring that out with the show. You know what I mean? We were still figuring out how we felt about these movies. And I think that that movie weirdly has sort of this, you know, again, when we started in 2017, I think that that movie was sort of like, yeah, it's a good movie. It's a really good movie. But like, is it a top tier 99 movie?
Yeah.
And in the subsequent 5 years, I think it's proven to be yes.
But. And it would have been a good movie to have a guest on. I mean, that's the only, that's a guesty movie.
Yeah.
John, before we go on.
Yes.
Whatever you feel like sharing, share. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I mean, I guess my question for you, John, is more like, how did we come into your radar a little bit? And what is it about movie podcasts that you love so much?
Well, I think you guys, I was trying to think of this. I think I became aware of you through Griffin
sure.
Newman when he guested on, I think, the Toy Story episode. And so he brought me over. Mm-hmm. And then I dove back into, started from the beginning with you guys. And, you know, obviously I think I'm basically the same age as you guys. So 99 was kind of a pivotal year for me as far as movies and really like opening my eyes to what was out there. So I mean, this podcast just spoke to me like directly. You know, movie podcasts, I don't know. That's basically all I consume anymore, pretty much. I mean, if I'm watching a movie, it's because I'm watching it for a podcast anymore at this point. So,
did you like Barry Lyndon?
I love Barry Lyndon.
I still haven't watched it yet. I got to watch that one.
I've never seen it either, embarrassingly. And it's like so many of these movies, particularly the Kubrick run that they're doing, but stuff for us too. It's hard to carve out 3 hours.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like I've been wanting to watch Barry, like even last night, right? I went and watched Long Goodbye because I had 2 hours.
Sure.
You know, but I don't have 3 hours very often. So I really want to watch Barry Lyndon.
I will say it's a very gentle, slow watch, maybe multitask while you're doing it, but it goes down pretty smooth. It's definitely not a slog.
John, are you you work in film? Tell us more. I really don't know much. What part of the country are you coming from?
I'm coming from Iowa.
Right.
I think Phil and I talked about doing a holiday style swap when you guys did the Field of Dreams. So.
Oh yeah. Where in Iowa are you? Are you?
I'm in Des Moines, the capital. Right. So.
Cool.
But no, I don't work in film in any sense of the word. So I'm in insurance. Des Moines is amazing. The insurance capital of the Midwest. So,
interesting.
Yeah,
there's
Hartford in the east and Des Moines in the Midwest. So,
have you always been a movie fan? I mean, has it just always been a thing for you?
It has. Yeah. When I had kids, I kind of dropped off. I wasn't able to see as many. And then
tell me about it.
I started listening to Blank Check, and they kind of brought me back into it. And Letterboxd is dangerous because that kind of gamified it, and now you got to make lists and complete lists. And
I'm trying to stay off Letterboxd.
Same. I dipped my toe into those waters. I guess early pandemic, and I was just like, you know, I got enough stuff like this in my life.
It's like, remember Phil when we were going to try to do the film log, the Soderberghian film logs for a whole year? I know you lasted a day. I think I lasted about 4 weeks, but even that, I really want to. Like, I really would love to be someone who had an extensive Letterboxd and you know, put everything on there. But it's daunting.
It feels a little like homework, unfortunately. And I want movies to be fun for me. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's part of why, like, this podcast is sort of the perfect amalgamation of that for me, which is that it's social and it's fun and we're talking movies and whatever. It gives me an excuse to watch films that I haven't seen before, or rewatch films that I love. So in that regard, it's I think you have to be of a certain personality. Looking at David Sims and his infamous grid or spreadsheet, you know, he's been doing it since he was a teenager. Like, he clearly really
jealous.
I'm jealous too, because it must be an amazing document, right, to have.
Yeah,
but I'm also just,
or
like,
even Joe Reed's Word doc. I mean, like, the idea of having, and like, I'm just, it's annoying living on the internet to some extent, because I always thought I was the biggest nerd and the best nerd.
Sure.
Right. Like, I thought I was the biggest of the best, and I knew everything. My party trick in college was naming Oscar winners, the best picture winners back to '68. And you get on the internet, and like Joe Reed, for instance, just fucking shames me, just humiliates, just pantses me. So it's just like, it's just, you know, I almost feel like I have to get out of the competition because I can't win.
Well, but I mean, yes.
All right, I won't leave.
I would just say, I know what you're coming from. I don't personally attempt to hold myself up to those people, because I mean, Griffin's the same thing, right? Like, Griffin's knowledge of, you know, the minutiae is unbelievable. So, you know, I'm just happy to be, you know, invited to the party. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's nice to have a seat at the table. I completely agree.
So, we're here to talk, everyone's favorite film from 1999, Human Traffic, a movie that, if I'm being completely honest, I'm not sure I knew existed.
Yeah. John, did you suggest this?
No.
Well,
was this on our list? This was on our list, Phil, because like you're like, John doesn't want to do it. I'm like, well, that's too bad. I guess the whole podcast is going to have to end. And then he's like,
yeah.
he's like, okay, John, we'll do Human Traffic. I'm like, oh, that must be some obscure movie only he's heard of, because I didn't even realize it was on our list.
It was on our deep cuts list. I mean, sure. This movie barely got a theatrical release for all intents and purposes. And I think that ultimately what happened was you and I, Kenny, had sort of figured out what films we wanted to cover just to be completists. But we were also sort of like, how do we do this in a way that isn't just like dumping a bunch of shit? Like we wanted to, and thankfully, you know, this fan episode has given us an opportunity to be able to kind of talk about these films and have you on, John, and some other people too. So I sent you that list, and Human Traffic was on that list. And John was kind enough to take the 90 minutes out of his life to watch this film. And we appreciate that.
84.
84. You know, there are two cuts of this, right? Are you aware?
Are really?
I think there's three.
So there may be three, but this is very weird to me. I've never heard of anything like this. There's a 99-minute UK theatrical version that is bawdier and rowdier and, you know, also has, like, UK-specific references that get turned into odd references in the version we watch. This 84-minute version you can get on iTunes, which is the US version. Like, one of the characters says she's going to go watch Jerry Springer, which I thought, oh, they have Jerry Springer. Well, in the original, it wasn't Jerry Springer.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It was some obscure British person. And there are all sorts of things like that that are almost, it almost reminds me of like when you had like, we did it on Entourage where, you know, you had an HBO show that was hopefully going to go syndicated on a place that has standards. You know, we would actually shoot him two ways. We'd shoot it with the curses and without the curses. We'd shoot it with the nudity and without the nudity. Wow. It reminds me a little bit of that. I mean, by not like season one, but by like season four or five, and we're like, yeah, this is gonna happen. Like, let's be smart about it.
That's really interesting, because I mean, first of all, I think that is smart, because watching Sex and the City on E is a brutal experience when they just literally butcher it. You know, it's what's interesting about what you're saying in terms of changing some of the references in this. It makes me think about a few years previous to Human Traffic was Trainspotting, a movie that I imagine you guys that we'll talk about in the context of this film.
Mentioned in context in this film.
Yeah.
In dialogue.
I remember when that came out, I think it was 97, 96, 97, something like that.
96 sounds right.
And I remember one of the conversations around that film was, what the hell are they talking about? Like, there's a lot of stuff in Trainspotting in terms of some of the references. They're obviously their accents being very thick. And I obviously think that's part of the culture of the film, but my guess is that they were hoping that maybe this movie could break out a little bit more if there wasn't any sort of alienating components to it. But I don't think that was the case. This film, Human Traffic, the synopsis of it is for Jip, Lulu, Coop, Nina, and Moth, the dead-end jobs they endure. Great names. The dead-end jobs they endure during the week just kill the time until Friday night. That's when they cut loose and get on the crazy roller coaster that takes them. Who wrote this? That takes them right through to Monday morning. An adrenaline-pumped comedy, Human Traffic chronicles the ups and downs, both chemical and emotional, for five friends whose weekends are filled with endless clubbing, pubbing, and partying, where there are no limits, and no rules, and no saying no. Human Traffic screened at the Toronto International Film Festival on September 11th, 1999. It later opened worldwide throughout 99 and 2000. It would go on to make around $5 million on a $5 million budget, which is crazy, crazy to me, but it's got 59% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 89% from audiences. 89% from audiences. Just want to repeat that. Ebert gave the film 2 stars, said, act like an adult, be fake. So says one of the feckless heroes of Human Traffic, a sad comedy about druggies in Wales. This movie is about how he and his friends are already acting like adults. They're right that many adults are fakes, but some adults at least know that when they're faking it, these kids are clueless. They know how to take drugs and feel good. That doesn't require cleverness. There's definitely more to their relationships than just going on in terms of going out, taking drugs, and having a good time, says Nicola Reynolds, an actress in the film. They are strong, strong friendships. And the more they know, the more they go through things together, the more their bond strengthens.
you know, the difference between a real friend and a real party is when you have a flat tire, the real friend goes outside in the rain and helps you change it. The party friend says bummer and buys you a drink. I think Eber's understanding or his perspective on this film isn't entirely without merit. I don't know that these... I think that to your point, Kenny, earlier before we got on mic, I do think that the third act of this film has some heart and some soul. I found the first two thirds exhausting. Truly repetitive and exhausting. I don't know how you felt.
John, how did you feel?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd echo the same thing. I mean, it's definitely a movie of two halves. It's almost like the director forgot to do all the crazy shit that he was doing in the first half and the second half. And I don't know if it's like, I don't know if it's a commentary that the point of the movie, the beginning where they're sober is the most manic and crazy. And the point where they're on drugs is when it chills out and that's when they're normal. Yep. I don't know if that's what they're trying to say, but that kind of felt like what they might've been going for. I don't know if that was explicit.
No, I think that's a good, I think that's a good point. I think that, you know, Kenny, you mentioned when we were recording yesterday, Go.
Yeah, Go. I mean, it reminds me a lot of Go, just in terms of its world. It also reminds me of 200 Cigarettes.
Yep.
You know, a lot as well. Yep. It just, it there is something obviously in the zeitgeist worldwide. Obviously, 200 Cigarettes didn't take place in modern times, but it had that kind of same club kiddie vibe. You know, I maintain no one has ever really done a great movie about rave culture. You know, I guess Go is the closest, a movie that I used to love and no longer think is a masterpiece. But no one's ever really knocked that down. But, you know,
it was short-lived, too, to be clear. Like the rave, I mean, not to say that it wasn't a big deal.
No, it was, but it was the thing for me, at least, is it was exactly when I was coming of age as a grown-up, right? So it was, you know, I always think about this just in terms of drugs and not to get too like drug, you know, drug related or whatever, but there was really only like a 4 or 5 year period in the last like 40 years where ecstasy supplanted cocaine as the party drug of choice. It happened again in like maybe around 2000 with the advent of Molly, but it really was just this little like blip around like 96 to like 2001, 2002. And I don't feel like any filmmaker really like did a good job of explaining how that was different in every way, how that, you know, gave rise to EDM culture, gave rise to this rave culture and gave rise, you know, ecstasy is a very different drug than cocaine. People don't fight an ecstasy. So it's a different, very different kind of, you know, vibe in the late 90s in these clubs, you know, worldwide. So whatever, I think that's over here. This movie, you know, is a little too Pee Wee's Playhouse to me, a little too Grooves in the Heart for me, you know, a little too like, you know, really just manic in its filmmaking style. I'm gonna John, because you're on, I'm gonna reevaluate Go right now. Go is a 75, so we can do that. Just so when I review this when I give this a higher number than Go, I'm not doing that. Like Go is a 75. Go is like much better than I thought. I think about
I'm gonna rewatch Go as well.
And I think about it all the time. Yeah, I really do love so much of it. Like I think at the beginning of this podcast, we were definitely on some like, God, this is not the movie I thought it was. God, there's some really uncomfortable things here. Yes. God, this is like, you know, like real fucking homophobic. There are storylines
in Go that don't age well, and that's the stuff that I think at the time when we reviewed it early in the podcast, we probably leaned a little too hard into.
Exactly, and we were also kind of, you know, we were coming off American Pie too, which I believe, and American Beauty.
Yes.
So, which, you know, our perspective. No, our criticisms of those movies hold up. We were dead on with those two. I don't think we were dead on with Go. Okay. Goes to 75. Human trafficking. Like I think the first half is pretty, you know, like intolerable. It's exhausting, but they do set some things up. Particularly Jip's impotence,
correct,
which I am always a sucker for an impotency plot line. And they play that out really well. His internal monologue, the honesty of that. As someone who's experienced impotency in my youth, the constant chorus of people in your of voices in your head saying you're not man enough, or are you gay, or what's wrong with you, or what's happening, the cacophony of
self-judgment.
Self-judgment, but the inability to enjoy the moment, it really is some another thing that I feel like has never been told in an interesting, honest way. And I think this is kind of the best job I've ever seen, frankly.
I completely agree with you that is unquestionably the best part of this film. It is the most real part of this film. It is the most human part of this film. And the arc of Jip's character is the best and most delineated arc. The problem ultimately is sort of with the stuff you were talking about up top. I felt like I was inside. Remember that old Budweiser ad with the guys that were calling each other?
Oh, sure. What's phone? Up? What's up? Yeah, I believe that's isn't that a 99 like, ad?
I don't know. But
frogs? I can't remember.
But I don't remember. But I felt like I was in that. There are scenes on the phone where I was like, get me the fuck out of this scene. Like, get me out of this headspace.
That McDonald's scene, I don't know what that was. That was something out of a cartoon.
That was so funny, John, because that was supposed to be a McDonald's, but it so clearly was the lobby of a movie theater, and they were selling only popcorn. It was great. that felt like Troll 2. That like Troll 2 levels of like, what are you guys doing?
It really just felt like this. So this, I looked into this filmmaker, writer, director of this film. He made a sequel to this film a few years later to catch up with these characters. My guess is that this film did well overseas. My guess is this film did well in the UK. And, you know, ultimately, as was the case around that time, Miramax decided to distribute it. I don't know how well it did over here. It's a movie that kind of didn't make much of an impression over here. At least I'd never heard of it. That's not to say that, you know, but it's really that first half. All the other characters kind of blend into one another. Jip's really the only one that kind of popped for me. I knew we were in for a rough ride from the first 5 minutes, where there's just all this fourth wall breakage and, you know, all this VO and just like all this sort of like unnecessary noise that I felt was just kind of drowning out any of the potential character, you know, work that he was perhaps trying to do. But the back half, to your point, Kenny, when everything kind of slows down, when the drugs start to fade away, and everyone has to kind of really deal with their lives, I appreciated that. And I do think that that part of the film did make it a lot stronger. But my God, it was just the beginning. Yeah. It's trying so hard to be cool. It's just exhausting.
That's right. It's trying so hard to be cool. And, you know, as we've established, Brits aren't cool. So
I was going to ask you, does this movie think these characters are cool?
I think
it does in the beginning, for sure. Or at least it's trying to convey that so that perhaps in the third act, when we realize that they're not cool, that I don't know. I'm not sure.
I don't know if we ever.
I'm not sure.
I don't know if we ever realize that they're not cool. I think these are supposed to be cool people. I really do. I think like I have a lot of thoughts about, you know, kind of British culture, British characters waiting in the wake of American hip hop. I think it's very weird, very strange. I understand why it happens. I understand hip hop is, you know, a global, you know, export essentially.
Sure, sure, sure.
But there's a lot of cosplay that goes on in these European countries when it comes to that. And there is no one to check them. So sometimes it kind of metastasizes out of control. Yeah. And a guy like Jip all of a sudden is a cool guy. You just come here where people are fooled by their accents and think they're cool just for living. But what's up, John?
Yeah. I noticed that too. In Moff, he's got like a Confederate flag on his wall. And I bet if you ask the director, like, why is that there? I don't know that he would necessarily have an answer. I don't know. I mean, it's just weird when you see these things that are divorced from their cultural significance imported into a different culture and they just take on their own meaning. There were a lot of things on their walls that were kind of that way. And the rap, when the guy comes in to buy the records, like there's just this cultural appropriation thing that's going on that is really interesting.
Lovely to see how stupid the Brits are when, you know, when they're left to their own devices too, because I feel like it's such an American, you know, it's such a criticism of Americans that we're so, you know, like culturally blind to where things come from and the, you know, appropriating and putting things on our wall, essentially devoid of context. But yeah, these dumb Brits do it too. And I think the Confederate flag in particular was really a great one. His Moff's walls looked like a fucking TGIF.
They right? do. It's funny.
Clear all those images. That's what I was wondering.
The spectrum of British film that we've watched over the last few months, even let alone over 5 years, is pretty fascinating to me. Sure, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. This Ratcatcher.
Warzone.
Another one. Sorry, that I've
Warzone,
exactly. Where you're just like,
didn't we just do another one like yesterday?
Maybe I don't know.
No, very recently before Ratcatcher, another whatever.
It doesn't. I mean, ultimately, what's fascinating about it to me is the spectrum of sort of the British experience that was done in film in 99, I think is fascinating. But like, it's also like this, I would say Human Traffic and Lock, Stock do have some similarities. There is a kind of Guy Ritchie-esque quality to this film a little bit in its broadness in terms of the comedic components. I feel like, you know, Guy Ritchie is obviously very broad in his humor as well. But then like you look at something like Ratcatcher or Warzone and you're just like, it's crazy what was coming out of the UK at that time. And it's not to say that the UK doesn't make lots of great films still, but like their output feels like it's lessened a little bit because I don't think those films transfer as well now or perform as well at the box offices that
you see. And then there are other, you know, it's a spectrum. It is what it is. Like there are other films that are, you know, kind of UK in spirit, even though they were probably financed by Americans. Like Notting Hill is basically a British film, you know, British filmmaker, mostly British cast, but British screenwriter, you know, and Felicia's Journey is basically, you know, a British film. And so, you know, you have all these movies that
it's fascinating.
You know, that show, it's, you know, it's these extremities that are particularly interesting to us. It's the Rat Catchers, you know, and short of some stuff that Harmony Korine does, you're not going to find another movie like Ratcatcher in America. We've done some lower budget E movies like this. Like this kind of feels like a Better Than Chocolate, which is a Canadian film, But this is an extremely British movie. So
it's an extremely British film. Weirdly trying to be American at times, which is its own weird thing. I mean, you guys obviously talked about the Jerry Springer thing, the McDonald's thing. Like this movie's trying to have its cake and eat it too. And I think in the process, it feels a little bit all over the place, which is, you know, a problem. The casting isn't bad. I actually don't mind the cast by and large. I think they're all pretty good. They're just saddled with not the greatest script in the world. What do you think of the cast, John?
I thought Chip was really good, actually.
Yeah, I did too. I did too.
I mean, the other ones I could take or leave. I mean, Moff, I don't know if I was just colored by how awful that character is, but sure. I didn't really care for him. But I thought Chip was really good. You know, the scenes of him at the house party with Coop, when they're it just seems like the actors are just riffing. I mean, those were the best scenes in the movie when it's just the actors just kind of hanging out and talking to each other. So, yeah, I thought that was really good.
You could also really sense Kenny. I mean, I don't want to read too much into it, but like the scene under the table with the cocaine, which felt like it went on forever. But that scene, you know, hard not to think of Boogie Nights, hard not to think of Scorsese at times, hard not to think about these either new, fresh American voices or classic American voices in cinema that's also kind of coursing through this movie.
It was interesting too. They did last forever, and they never snorted it. It just went on and on. Occasionally, they put it on their drugs, but Coop is just keeps making these lines thinner and thinner and thinner. Yeah. And I guess was mostly looking at that that metal straw. When's it going to fall off the table? But
I hate to be this person, but it is interesting watching a film like this. It screams like all its influences are on its sleeve. It feels like a first film. It feels like a guy who, you know, loves Tarantino. Lots of scenes of guys talking close to the way humans talk, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of that stuff. So it's unfortunate because, to your point earlier, Kenny, the impetus storyline, the sexual anxiety storyline of Jip, is really heartfelt and human. And you get the impression that the filmmaker really wants to talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
And that it's the real kind of like emotional spine of his film. But it's so at odds with everything else going on around it that you're just like, I don't even know what to make of this, but anyway.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
When you're going through that, it really does kind of, you know, overtake anything else.
Sure. Sure.
And I think it did. I actually think like, I can't remember anything that happened to Coop. Hardly anything that happened with Moff. I don't even remember Coop's girlfriend's name. I thought Lulu was really great and interesting. I thought they had a lovely relationship, and I thought the Gyps thing was really great too.
Yep.
I think there is, you know, I think there is a version of this with a better producer and a better studio that says all of that stuff.
Yep.
You know, that's background noise. Focus on this thing that's happening in the middle, and you could have a really strong story about a character at odds with himself. But I see it there. I think, you know, they certainly ended it on purpose with this almost singing in the rain-esque last moment, you know, with this massive fucking crane shot over Screech and Carter. They blew half their budget on this one shot, but it was worth it. So I'm
curious, we'll rate this, but John, in terms of 99, are there other films for you, obviously outside of Human Traffic, but like what movies popped for you in 99 back then and maybe upon rewatch?
Yeah, I hate having to admit this, but you know, Fight Club was don't and it, still is like
it's great.
My you listened to movie. You listened to the episode. We love it.
Yeah. I did. Yeah. But you tell that to people and there's immediately a assumption about what kind of person you are.
It sucks. It sucks having to be like, I love Fight Club, but not like those guys love Fight Club.
Fight Club. I mean, obviously, Talented Mr. Ripley. Sure. Magnolia. I've been holding off on rewatching Being John Malkovich for your episode. So I've got the Criterion Blu-ray that's been sitting around for like a year. So
it's coming up.
I have not watched that in probably since it came out.
Oh wow. Yeah. I think
you're gonna like it.
Yeah. And it's a great episode. I mean, Mark and Adam are fantastic guests. Yeah, I mean I if I'm being honest, I haven't rewatched Magnolia in a very long time. I mean bits and pieces here and there over the years, but I've kind of held off on that. I don't know about you, Kenny, in terms of
I haven't watched it in an insanely long time. You know, it's because you know, life goes so fast. I mean, at one point in my life, I owned 3 DVDs of three times.
VHS and like DVD.
Not even like that. I don't know how I wound up with 3 separate DVDs of this film. That's too funny. But I know I wore it out like almost more than any other movie I've ever had. That and then World Tenenbaums with 2 movies I just fucking wore out.
Sure.
But yeah, I can't tell you the last time I sat down and watched it. I mean, it could have 15 years. So
I actually before we do the episode, I want to I'm gonna buy the shooting script because you know that they published that. So I want to read that, and I also want to rewatch the documentary on the making of it that he did, because that's like the only special feature on the Blu-ray and the DVD back in the day was like a half hour documentary about the making of it.
I'll have to go into my storage unit and pull it out.
Find one of your 3.
Pull out one of my 3. I think I sent you a picture of all of the DVDs from 99 that I owned back when I thought I would actually watch them on DVD, which I never did. Yeah. And I think I had three Magnolias in that picture.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So John, were there back in 99, I'm assuming you went to see a lot of movies, right? I mean, you were.
Yeah, I was there pretty much every weekend. Yeah. That was the height of movie watching in my life. So pretty much every week.
Is there a movie that, just out of curiosity, is there a movie that you loved back then that you don't love now, or vice versa? Something that's changed over the 20 some odd years for you?
I don't watch that like ever. I mean, I think I own it, but back then I loved it. I had the soundtrack. I listened to the soundtrack too.
Me too. So you're someone who knows all the works of Troubled by the Way We Came Together, like me.
Potentially. We'll try that later. But that was one of the things I noted with this movie. Like I don't remember any of the music from Human Traffic, and you compare that with Go, and it's just like completely opposite. I mean, yeah. I looked at like the track listing on Wikipedia, and it's like there's names here I recognize, but I could not tell you a single song that played in the movie.
Which is too bad.
I completely agree with you. And I would also say too that the visual style, and I would argue that the script itself is so smothering. You know what I mean? Like it's hard to even really process what's going on a lot of the time. That like, it's not to say that the music shouldn't pop, it does, and I don't remember any of it either, but it just goes to show that like when you're doing it right, the harmony of all of those things, forgive the pun, is special, right? Like you look at Go and, you know, say what you will about some of the stuff that doesn't work, the stuff that does work, and when the whole thing is kind of really humming and it's all kind of dovetailing together. I think about the Steppenwolf needle drop with the car blasting through. Like these are things that are burned in my brain from back then. That's the stuff that just that's the juice. That's what's great about
that. That's why it's a 75 now. All right, let's figure out what this one is.
So I didn't see this in 99. I came into this podcast at a 30. You know, I'm going to go up a little bit. I'm going to go up to a 40.
That's nice.
Just truly because of Jip's sexual anxiety storyline, his relationship with Lulu. I mean, I think that it's really good. I mean, I don't know what else to say. It's nice. It's human. It's well done. Everything else I think is essentially garbage, but I do think that stuff works. And I think the point you made, John, that a salient point and one, the sort of the up and down, the kind of yin and yang of this movie, of sort of the first half being the kind of like cacophony of craziness of what have you, and then the second half, whether or not it is conscious or, you know, of some sort of a thesis statement, I think there is something there. So I'm gonna go up to a 40. What about you, Kenny?
You know what? And the one thing we didn't mention, and I think this kind of relates to what you were talking about with regards to what John said, was there is that scene at the end of the five of them sitting around the table and Moff basically being like, that's it for me, I'm done. And, you know, Coop saying when the come down is worse than the, you know, the high, that's when, you know, you got to leave the party. And that's what happened to me. That's why I'm sober. Like, because at some point, it was just, you know, the next day was so much worse than the day, so much worse, where it's just like nothing is worth feeling like this. True. And that's the end. Like I basically, you know, called it a career. I was at a 53. I was charmed by I liked the storyline. I was charmed by the ending of it. I was charmed. I thought the sex scene between Lulu and Jip was really great. You're in both of their heads here, in both of their monologues. It is a little bit of male wish fulfillment that a woman would be that concerned with your feelings in the moment entirely, but it's pretty lovely. Also the moment when they kiss the first time, they really do have a nice story between them. I'm actually going to go up because I just remembered the, that last scene, which I think was pretty smart too. So I'm going to actually go all the way up to a 59 year. I think this movie lives in the 50s, but I think this is a 59. For all those reasons, I think it's hard is completely in the right place.
I think it's hard is in the
not right the place. World's not the world's worst movie.
Okay. What about you, John?
Yeah. I came in, I wrote down because I knew this was coming. I wrote down 45.
Yeah.
Is what I was coming in at. And that was because it's basically a hangout movie and it kind of lives or dies on the characters. And totally. Aside from Jip, I don't know that I really cared about the other people. I mean, Coop, his arc is he's jealous and I don't know that that ever even gets resolved at the end. And I couldn't tell you what the girls' arcs were, if they had any. So I was at a 45. I think I'm going to stay there because we haven't really said anything to change my mind on that. I think you guys are all kind of on the same page. I mean, it is oddly charming at the second half, but that first half is rough. Yeah. It really is.
I'm a slight recommend. I think you guys are slight recommend against.
Yeah, but I mean, I think we're all kind of in the same terrain. I'll say this, though. I mean, it just goes to show how well done the Jip and Lulu stuff is, because truly hard to recommend kind of anything else going on in this movie. So
I definitely thought this was maybe in the 20 zone for the first
same
45 minutes of this movie. Yeah. So yeah, but by the end I really was taken with it. Yep. What are you gonna do?
John, this was an absolute pleasure.
I'm so happy you did this. Thank you.
First of all, you had clearly nothing to worry about in terms of whether or not you were going to be additive or helpful, or this was absolutely lovely. We thank you not just for, obviously all the time you put into our wiki, but just, for going on this ride with us and listening to all these episodes. And, we've put people through the paces. There's a lot of movies that people probably wouldn't have watched without us. And we appreciate that you went on this journey with us, truly.
Yeah, well, I'm thrilled to do it. I had a lot of fun, so thank you guys for inviting me.
Absolutely,
all right.
And we'll see you on the internet.
Take care. Great to meet you, John. Bye. Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999, commanding a wing here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Goh.
Commanding a wing, I don't know.
Sure.
And we are back with another episode with a treasured fan of the show. Amanda H on Twitter. I never knew your last name. Do you mind me saying it, Amanda?
I'm gonna go right ahead.
Amanda Heldsinger, Beatrix Kiddo on Twitter, and one of our most valued fans. Thank you so much for being a fan of the show, for engaging with us on Twitter. You're obviously a big fan of films. Like, your knowledge runs wildly deep and very, very varied. I mean, you see, I mean, based on Twitter, sure, you seem to know a lot about a lot. Why is that?
I have been watching a lot of movies for a very long time, since I was like a tiny, tiny kid. I just like lots of different kinds.
I mean, the truth is, I agree with Kenny. Your knowledge is deep and broad, which I think perhaps is why you like 99 as much as you do. It seems as though it's a varied year, obviously, but was it a special year for you? How did 99 speak to you?
I think 99 was the first year that I was really getting into what was coming out like new. I had always watched a lot of like older movies, or like even the 80s and the early 90s. And then by 99, I was 12. So that was kind of a big year for really starting to take in what was coming out, mm-hmm, new in movies.
I mean, so as was the case, I gave a handful of movies options to some of our fans, and you picked Wing Commander, which was which was one of the batch of movies that I suggested. I had never seen this film. Had you seen this film before?
I had. I saw it in 99 in the theater.
Wow. That's hardcore.
What made you see Wing Commander?
Yeah.
It was entirely Freddie Prinze Jr.
Sure.
That's what I thought, maybe.
That tracks.
Freddie and I don't know if Matthew Lillard was a draw at all for you either.
He definitely was too. Anyone from Scream, I would see in anything. I would watch him in anything.
I would too, except for Wing Commander.
We are drawing the line somewhere.
But I really, I hear you because I did. I mean, look, I saw Scooby-Doo in the theater for that. You know, it's like, these are my people.
Scooby-Doo, a vastly superior film to Wing Commander. But Kenny, not a Scooby-Doo fan?
I don't think Scooby-Doo is very good. It's so mean. Yeah, it's so mean spirited. It's like,
it's true.
And it's not like, I don't know, I really dislike Scooby-Doo, to be honest, not to get too much into it, but like...
Wait, the IP of Scooby-Doo or this?
Oh, movie? I love the IP of Scooby-Doo. Okay. Watched it incessantly as a child. I think the nastiness towards Scrappy-Doo, it's not that Scrappy's such a wonderful character. It's that
I love that this is the best take you've ever had. One of the best takes.
It's that. All right. So there are two reasons. One, the Scooby-Doo ending is worth keeping, right? It's a classic ending. It's one of the best things they have going on the show. If you want to get meta about that, right?
Yeah.
Don't get meta about this like random ass character that's already been shit on constantly. It would be like if they did a fucking Star Wars show and they had Jar Jar Binks be the villain. Like, yeah. I get it, guys. You know, I'm like Scrappy. I get it. But like, but like, come on. Like, give me a Scooby-Doo ending. Like,
no, I hear that. It's, you know, I think the thing about, I mean, not to make this a Scooby-Doo episode, but I'll just say that because I remember, as I'm sure maybe both of you do, like a Scooby-Doo movie was a talked about thing for a while.
Bit of a white whale.
Right. It had these illustrious casts attached to it for a really long time. You know, you had your Jim Carrey as Shaggy. You had your, you know, there was a Mike Myers version. There were all these different versions with like mega stars. And then this, the one that got sort of, I don't want to say cobbled together, that pulled together was Matthew Lillard, Freddie Prinze Jr., Sarah Michelle Gellar, and Linda Cardellini, which was sort of this, in hindsight, pretty great cast of, you know, 20 somethings.
Pretty appropriate big at the time. Cast.
Yeah. And Matthew Lillard, a great Shaggy, by the way, like a great Shaggy. And it looks good, even though I don't love how CG, you know, Scooby is, but that is what it is. Like, I rewatched Scooby-Doo
Man in a dog suit might have been preferable.
It might have been better. But I watched it on HBO Max, I don't know, I want to say 6-8 months ago, and I was pleasantly surprised by, I'll be honest, I didn't finish it. I watched like the first half of it, so perhaps the reveal at the end might not have worked for me as well. But it just, I was like, this is an affable movie. I get why this thing was a hit, but like, I also get why it didn't really hit the zeitgeist either. It's not that cool.
It's God, to talk about Scooby, and I would love to hear your opinions on this.
Yeah, movie. Amanda, did you see Scooby-Doo in the theater?
I did. I hated it.
Oh, okay.
I actually
was it because of Scrappy? Part. Was it the Scrappy reveal that really bothered you?
I just remember thinking that it was really stupid and seeing it with a friend who loved it and like getting into a fight because she was like, no, it's really good. And I had no time for Scooby-Doo. I thought it was terrible.
It's very childish. It's aimed at a younger audience.
I haven't seen it in years, but that was my complaint at the time.
Yeah.
It feels very confused with what it's trying to be because it is childish, but also there's meanness, there's attempts at sexiness, there's attempts at stoner humor. There's this signaling to an older audience that we're still for you, but I don't feel like that's the way it is. Totally. It's almost the inverse of the way Pixar does it, which, you know,
I mean,
Pixar signals it's for audiences by being about, you know, traumatic themes.
Well, it's interesting because the director of Scooby-Doo, if I'm not mistaken, is the director of Mystery Men, which was in her 99 film. I think it's the same director, if I'm not mistaken. And let me just look that up. Just
another bit of a misfire. But.
Well, that's kind of my point, which is that tonally, it's a really tough thing to crack. And I don't think, Raja Gosnell, who also did Mystery Men, which is another movie that, wait, no, it wasn't Mystery Men. It was Never Been Kissed.
Raja Gosnell was like the editor of the Home Alone movies.
Yeah.
I'm 99% sure at some point he was the director of Ravenous. Like he.
Yes.
He had a weird career.
Weird career. Yeah. This is all just to say, like, he did the Smurfs movies. He did Beverly Hills Chihuahua. This is all to say, Amanda, what you're saying.
A real author.
Saying, Kenny or two are two, all make sense, right? Which is trying to make kids movies that parents won't want to blow their brains at watching, but at the same time aren't fully committed to making something that, you know, an older audience will actually enjoy,
which has almost never happened. Correct. Like this thing.
Yes.
I guess the one time it worked, and I hate this movie, but the one time it worked was Shrek. And I think a whole generation of studio execs got the wrong idea from Shrek or the right idea from Shrek. They did
Katzenberg.
All of Illumination, all of Blue Sky, everything like everything that's not like foreign or Pixar or Disney Animation, took this idea of, you know, really childish, goofy story and adult-ish jokes, usually just means poop jokes, or allusions to what's happening in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's like inside baseball jokes, or like it's bizarre.
I know. Yeah. All right, Amanda, let's talk a little bit about.
So you saw this in the theater,
Wing Commander.
Wing Commander.
I did. Yes.
Okay, you saw this in the theater. Did you like it?
I don't think I ever thought about it again after seeing it.
Sure.
I remember. That's the right answer. It was really weird because for some reason I was convinced that if I hadn't played one of the games, I would be like lost seeing the movie.
Are you not
totally wrong? But
are you a game player?
A little bit. I dabble. And my brother he wasn't really into Wing Commander, but he had one of them. And I remember like making him teach me how to play it because I was like, I have like a week before I see the movie. I have to learn the mythos or I will be lost.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. This movie has a surprising amount of like canon and like techno babble bullshit that I was surprised at. Did you feel that way?
I didn't remember any of that. Sorry to jump in.
No. First of all, I know of a game called Wing Commander. I never played it in my life.
I don't even know what platform it's for.
I believe it was a computer game.
That's what I thought. It's a PC game, right?
I believe it's a PC game.
How maybe I'm weird. Wrong.
Yeah. Super.
Is that right, Amanda? It's a PC game, right?
It was, yeah. And it was known for, it was one of the first ones to introduce like really extensive cutscenes with like actors that you recognized. Because I remember the one I played had Malcolm McDowell in it and Mark Hamill.
So that's what's something that's particularly interesting, and I guess this makes perfect sense in light of what you just said, is the creator of the video game series is also the director, or the writer and director of the movie. Yes. So he's like he's like the kind of guy that you see all over Hollywood now who's like, we have to think of all the permutations of what this can be. This can be a movie. This could be this could be on Meta. There could be an Instagram live series. And he like did it. He did it in 99. And here we go. Wing Commander. This is the forebearer of everything that we're experiencing now. I say that as someone who's literally pitching something to Meta in a week. But
I know I agree with you, Kenny. It's weird because like when I hit play on this, first of all, I was shocked that like this movie tries to, over the credits, attempts to cover hundreds of years of human history and technology.
Best part of the movie. Kennedy, the best part of the movie. Like that actually was great. That was like the American history version of Omega Code.
That's you what know? I thought too. Yeah, yeah. I was watching. I was like, "Oh boy, this is Omega Code all over again," except with like space shit. It was interesting that like you texted me, Kenny, and I completely agree with you that this movie is so sincere and so serious. For all the only person who feels a little bit, I mean, listen, Matthew Lillard, big fan, love him. And he's clearly like the quote unquote comedic relief, if you will, of the film. And I do think that Freddie Prinze Jr. from time to time kind of gets a little winky. But most of all, mostly the movie's just deathly serious.
Yeah,
that was what surprised me, is I thought it would have a like a little bit of a sense of humor, and it doesn't at all.
No. There's no, like, it's bizarre.
The one joke at the end with the, when the guy is like, oh, he's nice if you get to know him, about like the awful racist commander or whatever.
Yeah.
Why is that even a joke?
It's got a lot of like kind of Top Gun-y jokes at times. Like there's some like kind of obvious references to Top Gun. It's what's weird too, is that it proved to me, not that this is the first movie to do this, but like, it just goes to show that there's no amount of technology, babble, sci-fi tropes that can save you if you don't have characters and a story and charisma. Yeah. Like, it doesn't fucking matter. If anything, it just goes to show that, like, imagine Star Wars without Harrison Ford, right? Or without Carrie Fisher to sell you on that dialogue. I'm not trying to shit on Freddie.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Prince Jr. Or Saffron Burroughs and Matthew Lillard, but like, this is dialogue that has to be sold by people filled with stardom and charisma that can actually pull you in, and instead you're just like,
look, I struggle with Star Trek. And Star Trek is the gold standard,
yeah,
right? So like, bad Star Trek is like, yeah, is like nails on a chalkboard to me. This is, yep, basically nails on a chalkboard to me. I will say though, yeah, I thought Lillard and the actress who played Rosie had,
yes,
really good chemistry.
I agree.
And I did feel when she died. I mean, Lillard was playing it really big, so he almost ruined the moment. But like, I did feel that mattered, and I thought their chemistry was hot, like actually. So, and I thought, like, I just thought they had a really hot vibe between them. So I don't feel like this was destined to fail necessarily, but I think the set design was kind of disgusting and ugly, claustrophobic in a way it didn't have to be.
All the cockpit shit looked terrible.
Some of the space stuff looked okay. Some of the flying stuff looked pretty good, yeah, but you know, I don't know. It's, I don't necessarily know what to do with a movie like this.
Well, you know, it made me think, and I didn't know this, Amanda, but when you said it kind of hit home for me. The whole thing feels like a cutscene from a video game, right? Like, and my assumption is that the director of those cutscenes was, you know, obviously the same guy who directed this. So it does all feel that way, right? Like, it feels stilted. It feels like the special effects would be impressive if I was watching them on my computer screen as opposed to watching them on a movie screen. It just goes to show that there's a chasm of difference, or at least there was in 99, between a video game and a movie. There's still obviously a big, you know, gap between them, but it's gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. And in 99, I think it was just too broad. But I do want to give just a touch of context for the people who haven't watched this movie, Space Adventure, with impressive special effects about a young crew who represent the last hope of an Earth menaced by an alien Kilrathi. After capturing a navigational device which shortcuts their route to Earth, the Kilrathi can only be intercepted by one team of fighter pilots. Who have to hold off the aliens until reinforcements arrive, based on the computer game of the same name, Wing Commander, opened on March 12th, 1999, against Analyze This, Cruel Intentions, The Rage, Carrie 2, and The Corruptor. It would go on to make $11.6 million on a $30 million budget. I mean, that's like 60 or 70 today. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's, we often, you'll go through your context and you'll say what something's opening against, and we'll make fun of it because it stood no chance. But very often those movies weren't trying to make a lot of money. This movie, $30 million, this movie definitely had aspirations of being a $100 million movie. Had to have.
What I would say too, the weird part of this is that, and we've talked obviously about this a lot, but you know, the release dates used to mean a lot more. Now you can basically release a movie any time of the year and it can be a big hit, right? Like back in the day, you had pockets of the schedule where you would essentially dump movies, right? And you know, March 12th, for all intents and purposes, is an early summer release.
By 99, I think March 12th, there's a level of expectation that you will 100%. Make money.
I mean, Matrix opens on March 31st, right? Like, it's interesting that, like, I mean, Analyze This was a big hit.
Yeah,
right.
Huge, like,
that was a perfect release.
Yeah, yeah. Great point. Yeah,
but I just, this movie just absolutely was obviously
desperate. I thought too that I think they paired it with the Phantom Menace trailer when that came.
They did.
So that seems like they clearly had some kind of higher aspirations.
And also, I think, you know, the hope was, we're going to put this Star Wars trailer on this movie, which weirdly, this was back in the day when people went to the movies to see a trailer for a highly anticipated movie.
If it was that kind of movie, yeah.
But I think that this was a lot of people bought tickets and left.
There was a famous version of that. I forgot what it was. Meet Joe Black. That's exactly what it was. Where Meet Joe Black made most of its money for people buying tickets to see the trailer and walking out. Yeah.
And in fact, there were a bunch of theaters that if people stuck through the whole movie, they'd show the trailer again at the end. Just be like, you sat through 3 hours of Meet Joe Black. We'll give you another Phantom
Menace. Smart. That's smart.
It is smart. Ebert gave this film 1 star.
It's our second Jar Jar illusion.
Oh, God. Freddie Prinze Jr. shows again an easy grace and instant likability. Matthew Lillard as a hotshot pilot named Maniac gets into a daredevil competition with the Holder character, and I enjoyed his energy. The perfectly named Saffron Burroughs has a pleasing presence as the head of the pilot squadron, although having recently seen her in a real movie, Mike Figgis's The Laws of Sexual Innocence at Sundance, I assume she took this role to pay the utility bills.
A real movie. Ouch. What about Deep Blue Sea?
Are at the service of a submaronic script and special effects that look like a video game writ large. Wing Commander arrives at the end of a week that began with the death of the creator of 2001, A Space Odyssey. Close the pod bay door, Hal, and turn off the lights. I guess Arthur C. Clarke must have passed away in March of 1999, which I guess makes sense.
No, perhaps. I think Kubrick passed away in March.
Oh, you're right. He's calling him the creator of 2001? Mm. Yeah, because Arthur C. Clarke lived past the year 2001, if I remember
correctly. No. Kubrick died right before Eyes Wide Shut, so it makes sense.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Weird illusion. Weird to call him the creator of 2001, but I guess that's whatever.
I don't know. That's who I thought of when he said it, but that's...
No, you're absolutely right. That makes absolute sense. He must have died in March. Movie came out in July. Mm. Yeah. Checky Caro, the only actor who feels like he completely understands what movie he's in, and by that I mean a bad one. He just seems to be like, whatever the fuck. He's having a good time though.
Well, it's what I said to you. The first thing I said, Amanda, I wonder your take on this, was this is sincere Starship Troopers.
Yes.
And that, you know, these beautiful, like, every, all these pilots are like laughably beautiful. Mm-hmm. And you know, male and female taking place in the future, you know, almost like this situation where everyone's living together and hugging each other and dressing together and fighting something. I mean, they're called the Kilrathi. I mean, that should be your unobtainium, you know, hobby horse. the Kilraki is a lot. And a lot. The Kilraki is bad. That's bad to me. That allusions of racism there. I don't like that at all. That's nasty. But that, you know, that the Kilraki works really well in a Verhoeven movie.
Yep.
You know,
or a Fifth Element. You know what I mean? Like, which is what their makeup kind of weirdly brought up in my head when I saw them show up at the end. I, you know,
Fifth Element is truly one of my favorite movies.
So good.
But I take absolutely no metaphor from that film.
What do you think of Fifth Element, Amanda?
I haven't seen it in a while, but I really love it.
It's so good. I think,
That said, that they had the same. It was the same director of photography on The Fifth Element and Wing Commander. I could be wrong. I thought I read that.
Oh no!
Which is surprising. That really surprised.
Oh no!
Right?
Oh no! It's so sad.
Because my main thing with Fifth Element is the visuals.
The visuals are incredible in The Fifth Element. Yeah. I mean, truly, just like that. I know I'm going to sound like a moron, but that's my Blade Runner, right? Like that, like, truly, it's like, I mean, it's not my Blade Runner thematically and all that stuff, but it is my Blade Runner visually. It is that is the movie that when I saw in the theater was like a shot to the cerebellum. And I don't think I've really seen anything that kind of hits me the same way visually as that film.
I agree. I mean, in that movie, I mean, I remember, so that movie, Fifth Element is a 98?
I think it's 97.
97. Right. And I remember seeing that in the theater and just being pretty gobsmacked by the special effects, by the visionary kind of look of it. I just really dug it. And then, you know, ultimately many movies have sort of, I don't want to say ripped it off, but certainly, you know, taken the path that it sort of, you know, created to some degree. But I don't know. This movie to me, you mentioned it earlier, Kenny, you know, that like, this is nails on a chalkboard to you. And it's amazing how quickly I disengaged from this movie, just because at a certain point, it became clear to me that I wasn't going to understand the world building necessarily. Like, just there's so much techno babble bullshit that I just found that just like literally just went like through my head. Like, I just couldn't hold on to any of it. Can we talk about Saffron Burrows for a second? Because I do feel
of course.
Like. So we obviously did Deep Blue Sea very early in the run, Kenny.
It's like one of our first five, right?
It was one of our first five. I wonder what you'd think of it now, because I know you weren't a particularly much of a fan of it back when we did it the first time. And I do wonder, through the prism of the 250 to 300 movies you've watched since, whether or not it holds up a little better. I feel the same way in the sense that, like, I'm not sure if it would or if it wouldn't. Saffron Burrows had a moment in 99 between this and that movie where I think they thought she could be like a new genre queen of some sort, but that obviously didn't happen.
I don't know the answer to that. Saffron, I mean, the thing I remember about Saffron Burrows from that movie, I mean, I remember her in that movie and she's stunning.
Yeah.
But the thing I remember is that she was supposed to like survive that film. And test audiences hated her character, not because of her, because her character was responsible for the, you know, the evil sharks.
Correct.
But they felt like she had to, you know, be die as a ritual sacrifice.
Correct.
And that feels like that's something that a different actress might have been able to avoid. Like there are other people. Now, if she's supposed to be, you know, a sympathetic protagonist at the end who just kind of let the science get out of control, I could imagine so many actresses who would be able to play that in a way that you wouldn't want them eaten by mutant sharks at the end. So
just a movie star that people liked too much.
No one would ever feed Sandra Bullock to the sharks.
Correct. Yes.
For instance.
Or a Kate Beckinsale for that matter. I mean, I think that there's.
No, probably not.
I just.
It's, or a Kate Bosworth. There are a lot of.
There's a lot of.
A lot of people.
I do think that like. She's. I think she's a lot better, and I don't mean to, I mean, I agree, I guess, with Ebert in the sense that she's just better in smaller character pieces. She's been in a couple of Mike Figgis films that she's good in. I think she's just better when she's playing smaller, grounded, you know, three-dimensional characters. I think that it takes a certain skill set to be able to play in the genre sandbox. Do you know what I mean? And be able to sort of, I mean, I don't think anybody could have been good in this movie, but I do think that, to your point about Deep Blue Sea, Kenny, that had she been, had there been someone else cast in Deep Blue Sea, I think they would have navigated, forgive me, but those waters better than Saffron Burroughs did. Cause I think it's asking a lot. It just is. It's a very different skill set. And for good or bad, I think that's hard to do. I'm certainly not going to fucking talk about the plot of this movie because it's pretty nonsensical, but I do want.
I was just going to say, have you seen Saffron Burroughs in Gangster Number One? That's my favorite one.
Good movie.
It's around the same time. And
Malcolm McDowell also.
I was going to say, they just mentioned that on the blank.
You did.
The Blank Check podcast. I've never seen this movie. I would like
it's a good
to.
Good movie. Paul Bettany, I believe, is the other actor in it. Am I crazy?
DVD.
Oh, there she's got the box ready at the ready. Yeah, and I remember that movie.
Yeah, it's my favorite. She basically just has to be like lovely, but she's really good in it.
It's one of those movies, Kenny, that I would sort of put in the Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels box of like a movie that didn't really do much at the theater, but like had a huge tail on video that a lot of people really loved. It's a good movie. Freddie Prinze Jr., when asked about Wing Commander, said, "I can't stand Wing Commander. I can't watch one scene of that movie. I read the script and loved it. So did my buddy Matthew Lillard. We both got the parts. We went on location and they said, here's the new script. It was a piece of crap." So I want to push back on this quote for a quick second here. And I'm curious about your thoughts about it, Kenny. It feels a little bit like, how can I put this? Actor gets script, reads script, bad script, but, you know, getting paid a fair amount of money for it could turn into something, could be a Star Wars, could hit the vein, and then pleads the fifth at the end and says, "I got a new script and it wasn't me. I didn't sign up for this. This movie turned out." There's a part of me that feels like I'm not suggesting that in features this doesn't happen. Rewrites happening all the time, getting new scripts that show up, all that sort of stuff. And actors use that as a scapegoat when the movie doesn't work. But if the movie does work, everyone looks like a genius. I'm just not convinced that the script that he read was some sort of a fucking masterpiece that turned into Wing Commander, if you understand what I'm saying.
I think you're probably right, considering it's directed by the guy who wrote it and also wrote the video game. So that's true. I think Freddie Prinze is fairly interesting. Now, as you know, Amanda, I'm a big WWE fan. Freddie Prinze wrote for WWE for a while.
Yep.
And like in his like interim, he's never really stopped acting, but he's a like a lifelong wrestling obsessive.
Okay.
And has like worked there. So he's kind of stayed like in my periphery through all this time. Mm-hmm. And one, he seems pretty smart. Yeah. And just in terms of like story sense and things like that, my sense from him is, and this has nothing to do with WWE, my sense from him is he never quite had the career he wanted to have. I think he doesn't quite understand why he never really got that shot at a real deal leading role, a meaty leading role. And so it's, you know, something like Wing Commander, which, you know,
you never
really know what's going to be the next big sci-fi smash. Yeah. I think he's a little upset that it wound up just kind of being a bomb. But
what, so Amanda, Freddie Prinze Jr., a big draw for you at 12, yes, right?
Very much.
he's a cutie. I'm not saying he's not. And I think he has charisma. That being said, do we think he's a good actor? I know it's a loaded question.
I would say maybe not upon reflection now as an adult.
But has charisma. Like, I'm not disagreeing with you, Kenny, in the sense that that's how he felt, right? The question I'm wondering as I look through his filmography and I think about like movies coming out around that time and the box he kind of got put in, which are sort of subpar rom-coms and, you know, a couple what have yous.
I rented all of those rom-coms too. Everyone.
Sure. I get, listen, She's All That. We talked about, obviously. He's very charming in it. Summer Catch. You know, there's a bunch of things he's in. I don't know that he actually has the bona fides, though. Do you think he has the talent to have should have been offered something?
Did you used to watch Boston Legal?
I did. Was he on it?
He was Shatner's son.
Okay.
And Shatner like won the Emmy and was a real kind of it was kind of a big like kind of late life breakout for him.
Yep.
And he was, you know, and Shatner was going toe to toe with Spader. So there was almost like this knock on effect where you had like this incredible actor in the lead role. You had Shatner going toe to toe to him with which elevated Shatner to Spader's level. Yep. And having Freddie Prinze come on and go toe to toe with Shatner elevated Freddie Prinze in my mind, which is like it probably would have been television, but there could have easily been that kind of role for him.
Yep. Yep.
In an elevated procedural or something like that, a character based procedural that where he could have had fun. He, not that this would have been a great career path for him, but like he easily could have been Chris O'Donnell in NCIS LA.
I was just
and had say, 20 and had 20 years of that kind of life.
I totally agree with you. It's interesting. He could have been on a Law and Order. I could have seen him, you know, I know this predates him, but one of Dennis Franz's partners on NYPD Blue. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, like, for sure.
You know what I mean?
Like, that would have been a good one for him.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I think he had that in him for sure. You know, it's interesting. He's obviously very content. It seems he had a sitcom briefly, right? He had Freddie. Which ran for a couple seasons, maybe. I don't know. I think he is content.
I think that's the big secret about him, which is like, I think he's totally fine with the way this all worked out. I think he's really happy with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Very happy.
They have a family. They're just like, they have money. She kind of works whenever she wants. Yep. And I think they're pretty happy.
Yeah. They figured it out.
The fuck is wrong with them?
So Amanda, do you have a favorite Freddie Prinze Jr. performance, or did you have one when you were 12?
I think it definitely would have been I Know What You Did Last Summer was the one that still was my all the way along.
They're all great in that movie. It's the thing, like, that's one of those they movies are, that like they're all just really at the peak of their powers, I feel like. You know, yeah, it's a great movie. So there's a bullet time moment in this movie, Kenny.
I know. I freaked out.
It's rough. And also like kind of unwarranted. Like, why did it even happen plot wise? I'm still unclear.
This actually predated The Matrix.
Isn't that crazy?
That was what I was wondering when that happened. As if I like snuck it in there really quickly.
Wait, that's crazy to think about, because I didn't realize until you read the release date.
Yeah.
This predated The Matrix. What so the
they technically fuck? Did bullet time first. Yeah, I don't think that they did bullet time. Well, obviously they didn't do it as effectively, but I also don't know that they did it actually with the same technique as The Matrix did, but I could be wrong. Because this bullet time seemed janky as fuck, whereas The Matrix like obviously looked fantastic. So I'm unclear as to how that even happened, but it happened. I don't know. It also just it felt so kind of shoehorned in there in terms of like just like how it happened in the story, why it happened in the story. Just all of a sudden the ship like just stops and everyone kind of does it's weird. Yes, Kenny, what's up?
I'm looking up stuff and
history of bullet time?
More or less history of bullet time. Bullet time before The Matrix. Do you guys remember that Gap ad that used bullet time?
With the girl jump or the guy jumps.
Yeah, that was 86.
Oh, seriously?
Produced in 86, released in, I don't know why I said 86 because I'm dyslexic. Produced in 96, released in 98. So 96, 98.
Wow. I guess it makes sense that technology existed before Matrix did it.
I mean, like, ultimately, when you think about it,
yeah,
it's not that impressive of a technology. Yeah. It's just one of those things where you just got to do it. You just got to put 100 cameras around someone.
It also just goes to show not the whole Mandela effect of it all. But I do think there is something to, we've associated this with the Matrix. So everything in my brain that did it, I just assume it's after.
I just assumed it was after too. And I assumed it. I also assumed that's why it was kind of bad, because it was almost remember Clash of the Titans did that retrofitting 3D thing. Yes. I thought it was just like, we should get them back in the studio and do one more bullet time thing because the Matrix did it and that will sell this movie.
Yep.
And again, it's not particularly difficult technology. You just have to rent 100 cameras for a day.
So you mentioned earlier the chemistry between Matthew Lillard and his romantic lead in this film, Rosie. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the chemistry between Freddie Prinze Jr. and Saffron Burroughs, or lack thereof?
Yeah, well, yeah, sure.
Did you think they had chemistry, Amanda?
Can you talk about something that's not there?
Not even a little bit. It was embarrassing.
Their kiss at the end actually kind of weirded me out a little bit. There's something about the way they kiss that I was like, I don't like this.
The actress who played Rosie is Ginny Holder, by the way, British actress.
There you go. Am I wrong? Did the kiss was it not a little weird, Amanda?
It was really weird. I'm kind of thinking though, with Freddie Prinze Jr., like she's all that. It doesn't really work. The romantic chemistry. He doesn't always necessarily have that good chemistry with his female co-stars, I would say. Upon reflection,
I don't think it works that well in She's All That. I agree with you. I think that I think that movie is quite overrated, with the exception of Kevin Pollak. But
She's All That's listen, we did a whole episode on She's All That, but I don't know that Freddie Prinze Jr. has chemistry with anyone except his wife.
Yeah, I think the same thing.
I think so too.
Yeah, but they have really nice chemistry together.
They're each other's lobster. What are you going to do?
Amanda, just out of curiosity, as we wrap this up, I wanted to ask, do you have any top 5 99 movies? What are your favorites? Just off the top of your head.
Blair Witch Project definitely is still one of my favorite movies. Love that movie. I loved it in 99. I love it now.
It's a great movie.
Talented for Mr. Ripley definitely is another one that's just so good. I'd say Ravenous definitely too. I love Ravenous.
Nice.
Ravenous is fucking great.
Sleepy Hollow too is the one I would say is, of course. I think what would be a last one? It's it really is such a great year. There's so many.
It really is a tremendous year, and I'm worried about when we have to do our final rankings, Kenny, because
I think I'm gonna do 25.
I think we
do 25.
Yeah.
And we have to.
Yeah,
I might do a 25 favorite and a 25 best.
I agree with you. I think we have to do, I think we should probably do that too. Personal versus.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really tough year to pick all that stuff out. But Amanda, we're so thankful that you've, yes, go ahead.
Can I just say one thing? Sorry.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I feel like I have to mention, you can't see it, but I am next to a poster of Anthony Perkins as Norman Bates.
Sure.
And I have to mention that it is still criminal that Psycho was not on your hotels and motel screen drafts. I have to say it. I'm sorry. Criminal.
You're right. You're absolutely right. You're right. You're absolutely right.
You're absolutely right.
Fellow screen draft fan who takes this stuff seriously, I appreciate it.
Listen, mistakes were made. I'm willing to admit that mistakes were made. But Psycho is a fucking amazing movie.
A hotel and motel draft without Psycho. Who would do such a thing?
Who? An idiot.
I should have just vetoed you. It's my fault.
Well, you know,
I wanted to keep the veto for my next draft. And it's important because I don't want to say what our next draft is, but it's a big draft.
I look forward to what it is.
You know what it is.
Do I know?
Don't say what it is, but Clay asked us, remember? He emailed us.
Yes, of course. Yeah, that's a yes, of course.
Yes.
Forgot about that.
Gotta keep those veets.
That's those veets. Yeah. So, Amanda, yes, go ahead, sir, please.
One last screen drops thing, I was listening to the New Camp Classics one, which is an older draft. And I think it was when they played Hackers. And I think Clay said that, does Matthew Lillard being in a movie make it inherently camp?
Oh, boy. That's an unfair thing to say. I don't think that's true.
I actually would have agreed with that. I think Wing Commander disproves that because it could be fun and campy, and it is not in any way.
He is a campy actor.
I don't
know that the entire film retroactively becomes campy because he's in it.
I don't think it's an insult. To me, camp is a high compliment.
Oh, no, for sure. Is Scream campy?
I assume you'd have, like, that would almost be the seed of this argument that Scream is campy.
I don't know that it is.
I just don't think, frankly, straight white bro, is he campy? I mean, like, not really, you know, that's not really a campy guy.
He's definitely cartoonish.
He's big.
He plays big. I know what you're saying, though, Amanda. I don't think you're wrong.
The Descendants is campy, so I agree with that.
Your favorite movie, The Descendants. That movie sucks. I'm not into that. I do think, though, watching this movie, I did think about Matthew Lillard's in the Twin Peaks new season, the most recent season of that. We are, I think, as an industry, sleeping on Matthew Lillard as a just an actor, a tremendous actor. Period.
I think that guy's got Twin Peaks.
He's fantastic. Like that, he has fucking chops, and I think that more people should cast him in stuff. And I think if I'm being honest, he's one of the best things in the Descendants. I think he's a good actor. But I know where Clay's coming from. I don't think Clay is completely off base in the fact that the element he brings to his movies tend to be dialed up to 11. So that
I don't know if you would say that now, to be honest. New Camp Classics was a while ago, right? That was a few years ago.
It was, yeah. I don't know how I missed it. It was when I was catching up on the older ones.
Yeah, Showgirls was like one, right? Something like that?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I am curious, though, Amanda. Did you listen to the Kirsten Dunst draft that I did with
Dana? I did. It was very, very, I was very happy with how it turned out.
Great. Glad to hear it.
And I'm
hoping I had a fight for that.
You guys are wild.
I'm hoping you do the third. It's a trilogy and you do a reteam for another 90s actor.
My hope is Natalie Portman is what I'm hoping we do next.
That would be fantastic.
But yeah, it's, man, there's just times where I'm just like, I feel like I can't believe I had to fight for an interview with the vampire. Like, it's just absolute madness.
So happy that you got it on there, because I thought that one wouldn't be a question. And then I got very nervous.
Yeah. Like when we got mid, I was like, wait a second, is this going to be a problem? Is she like, so let's rate this, Kenny. Neither of us saw this in 99.
Yes, of course.
I didn't see it in 99. I came into this podcast. I put this at a 20. After this podcast, I think I'm down to like a 19 or an 18. And I'm not even sure that we
can do that in the 20s. It's not that bad.
Really?
I give it a 29. Like, it's bad. Okay. But like it's bad, but it's not like offensive. I don't mean offensive like in terms of
You're right.
The whole
right.
thing isn't like it's not like
I'll stick it at 20. You're right.
Yeah, stick it at 20. I was at a 29 before, you know. I'm going to stay around at 29. It's like this movie sucks, but like it doesn't suck like suck. But Amanda, you rule. What are you going to give it?
Yeah. What did you think in 99
in the theater?
Oh, I probably would have given it like a 40 because it did have Freddie Prinze Jr. and Matthew Lillard, but I also never thought about it again.
that sounds fair. Where are you at now?
Now I would say probably like a 30, maybe 35, just because I'm like nostalgic for that kind of movie now, the really earnest kind of series.
That's fair. I texted Kenny about 10 minutes into this film and I was like, should this be rebooted? Like, is there something here on an IP level? And by the end I was like, no. But at the beginning, I was like, maybe. But yeah, I the weird thing is, I remember this film's release. Like, I remember this being
theaters. A little bit too.
Like, it made a little bit of an impact, which is interesting because
And as far as video game movies go, it does feel like it's trying to be its own thing and not trying to cater to video game players. It just, you know, it's ephemeral. Like, it's just another bad sci-fi movie from this period. And we've done a ton of them, actually. There are a lot of people, like, there's obviously something, you know, in the water where people felt like we were ready for a new sci-fi franchise. And Matrix is the one that won. And, you know, movies like the 13th Floor and this and other things are the ones that lost. And but, you know, there are a lot of people who are trying.
It's, you know, listen, it's another thing, you know, to add to the pile of 99 things that are interesting in terms of, you know, all of these movies seeing Star Wars, you know, coming and trying to figure out, is there a way for us to carve out our own little other things? And this movie obviously tried to do that. I commend them for trying, but it didn't totally work, obviously. But Amanda, this was a blast. This was an absolute pleasure to have you on.
I had so much fun. Thank you.
Yes, this is really wonderful. You're our favorite person.
you're supportive of our podcast. It's one of those things. You know, Kenny and I have talked about this as we wrap this up, this podcast. But like, you know, we did an episode with Mike Natale, and we talked with him about this as well. And it's just like those the people that support us and that love the podcast, they make it all worthwhile. And it just goes to show that like we're not just two guys screaming into the ether.
And it always and it makes us feel so much better when, not that, you know, any fan is great, but it's nice to have smart fans. So
also true.
It's great. We love the way you engage with us. You know, kind of at the top of your intelligence, and we don't, you know, it's really kind of impressive. Just, I'm impressed with ourselves that someone of your intellect is willing to give us your time. So thank you.
Thank you 100%. So much.
I also will say too, you know, as we, you know, Kenny suggested the idea of us reaching out to some of our fans to do this. And it's lovely to meet you. It's just great to, like, you know, put a face to the tweets, and to be able to, it's really nice. So we really do appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we will see you in the Twitterverse. Yes. And we thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Right, take care, man. Great to meet you.
Bye.